Okay, Chair, you're on the record.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer. All right. I will call to order the RTO Governance Committee meeting, May 16th, 2025 at 9 a.m. Jennifer, if we can get a roll call, please.
Yes, sir. Alaska Energy Authority?
Here.
Hatch Electric Association?
Arthur Miller, here.
City of Seward?
Brian Hickey, here.
Homer Electric Association?
Sarah Lamb, here.
Matanuska Electric Association?
John Sinclair, here.
Golden Valley Electric Association?
Travis Million, here.
And the Rail Belt Reliability Council?
Joel Groves, here.
You have a quorum, Chair.
All right, thank you. If we could go to public roll call, please.
Okay, yes, sir. We'll start with the lady to my left. You can state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, I'm Whitney Brown. I'm with Stoll Reeves. I work with Tina Grovier.
Daniel Heckman, Golden Valley.
Steve Colt, University of Alaska.
Jess Buhler, Outside Counsel to AGA.
Bill Price, AEA.
Karen Bell, Alaska Energy Authority.
Andrew Jensen, Governor's Office.
Mark Billings, the Alaska Energy Authority.
Matt Clarkson, Chigach.
Carl Renault, Consultant for the RTO Working Group.
Okay, and Chair, next we'll go to the folks that are on the Teams meeting. If they could state their name and affiliation for the record. Okay, can you all hear me on the Teams meeting? Hello? Okay, let me check. Let me check for someone. Okay, so I'm understanding that they can hear. So if there's anyone on the Teams meeting that would like to identify themselves, please state your name and affiliation for the record. Okay. On the Teams meeting? Okay, there's nothing muted. I might need to log off and log back on. Okay. So there's that. Okay, let me stop the recording. Okay, so we're going to go back to the folks on the Teams meeting. If you can state your name and affiliation for the record, that would be great. Okay, so you can hear us and we can't hear you. Are you unmuted? Yes. Okay, we can't hear you.
Okay, now I'll go back.
Let me see.
By the time you get there, she'll have to figure it out. Okay, I'm the same. Thank you.
Okay, can somebody on the Teams meeting try something now? Say something?
Can you hear us now?
Yes.
Okay. Larry Jorgensen, Homer Electric.
Tony Zellers, Matanuska Electric.
Molly Howard, Golden Valley Electric.
John Charles, Consultant for Matanuska Electric.
Okay, Chair, that's everybody on the Teams meeting.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer. Next item number four, the approval of the agenda. I need a motion for the approval of the agenda.
Please. Move to approve the agenda. Curtis Thayer, AEA.
Arthur Miller, second.
Okay. Any discussion changes? Hey, we got everybody in person today, so we don't have to do roll call vote. So seeing no objections, we'll go ahead and approve the agenda by general consent. Moving on to public comments.
Okay. Is there anybody in the room that would like to make a public comment? Okay, no public comment in the room. If there's anybody on the phone that would like to make a public comment, please press star 9 and you'll be recognized. Okay, there are no public comments, Chair.
All right, excellent. Thank you. Moving on to item 6, approval of the meeting minutes from the May 2nd, 2025 meeting, and you should have those minutes in your packet. Yeah, need a motion, please.
Move to approve the minutes of the May 2nd meeting.
Is there a second?
Second, Arthur Miller.
Any comments or discussion on the minutes?
I just want to double check on one thing. When we went into executive session, we did a roll call vote. Okay, never mind. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Seeing no further discussion, we'll go ahead and vote on the approval of the minutes. All those in favor of approving the minutes as presented, signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Motion carries. All right. Moving on to item 7, old business, the working group update. Mr. Heckman, over to you.
All righty. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Daniel Heckman, McGowan Valley. The governance committee last met on May 2nd, and in between that meeting and this meeting, the working group has met four times to continue to work on not only the deliverables for the RCA filing, principally the open access transmission tariff, which is going to be a subject of today's public discussion, but also the revenue mechanism and some of the cost allocation work that the utilities and the entities have begun working on that's also going to be fed into the open access transmission tariff. We will be kickstarting that discussion today, but more to come on that in successive governance committee meetings. But that has been the principal focus of the working group between the two governance committee meetings. We are slated to have another two-day workshop next week in advance of the 28th governance committee meeting that I assume that will do a lot of the takeaways from this meeting and then continue to really progress towards the July 1st filing, which is fast approaching. So that's kind of the high-level update, but a lot of the work that we've been doing is going to be discussed at today's meeting.
Excellent. Thank you. Any questions for Daniel? Okay. Hearing none, that will move us over to item 7B, RTO certificate filing and OAP filing. We have Whitney here in sitting in for Tina today. So, Whitney, over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, Governance Committee. My name is Whitney Brown. I work at Stoll Reeves with Tina Grovier, which serves as RTO counsel. My colleague, Tina, will be joining us remotely as she's able. She's traveling today. Since our last meeting, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska has issued an order that, among other things, denied both the motion and cross-motion for summary disposition that had been filed. In that order, the Commission also found that the RTO was fit, willing, and able to provide the services required by AS44.83.700-720, accepted the RTO stipulation with the Attorney General, and granted the RTO its certificate as the transmission organization for the Alaska Rail Belt. We have not yet received the certificate itself, but the Commission's order indicated that it would be sent under separate cover. I have no additions to Daniel's report on the BTS or the OATT. I do, however, have matters related to these topics and the topics listed under new business in the agenda to discuss in executive session, the immediate knowledge of which could have an adverse effect on the legal and financial position of the RTO and or the committee members. Thank you.
Any questions for Whitney? All right. Thank you very much. Okay. Moving on, item 8A, we're going to have a presentation today on HB 307 and the requirements for the backbone transmission system. Going into kind of the background of HB 307, a number of the different things looking at on how we will be evaluating and qualifying what is backbone transmission system. So, Daniel, I'll turn that one over to you as well.
Alrighty, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, for the record, this is Daniel Heckman with Golan Valley. I am also speaking, though, today on behalf of the RTO working group that has been doing a lot of work over the months since 307 was passed and even before then on this very topic. First, before I dive into this presentation, just want to acknowledge everyone on that team and those groups' efforts as we continue to work on a lot of this. As the chair mentioned, the purpose of this presentation is to really set the stage for really agenda items 8B and 8C, and to just really lay the groundwork for why are we here, why are we talking about the BTS, what did the working group do, and to really help frame the basis for the next couple of agenda items. So I'm just going to go ahead and get started here. For all of those who are listening on the public, HB 307 was a House bill that was introduced at the request of the governor's office, not this session, but last session, that amongst many things created the Railroad Transmission Organization. And the Railroad Transmission Organization, one of the core duties of that organization, this organization, is to administer a commission-approved, non-discriminatory, open-access transmission tariff specifically for the backbone transmission system. Now, what is that? The statute has addressed that. The backbone transmission system means transmission assets in the railroad electric system, and this is the system that goes from Fairbanks all the way down to the Seward and Homer areas that facilitate the transmission of electrical power under standards that are established by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So when you break that down into kind of the main points, again, what is the backbone transmission system? These are transmission assets, so they're not distribution assets, in the rail belt. So this is only addressing, again, the rail belt electric system going from Fairbanks down south towards Seward and Homer, none of the other areas like Copper Valley or anything outside of the rail belt is addressed through this legislation. These assets have to facilitate the transmission of electric power, and they have to be evaluated under standards that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has set. So then, in order to help guide this committee and really the working group efforts, the working group put together a proposed policy that the purpose of it, I'm just going to quote verbatim here, is to describe the standards and their application by the RTO when determining what transmission assets qualify to be included in this backbone transmission system, and that will be used for facilitating the transmission service under the open access transmission tariff. That is the purpose of what that policy is. That's going to be discussed a little bit later today. But then what are those standards that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has set? So to identify assets as transmission, there is what's called a seven-factor test. And these are used to determine if an asset can be categorized as distribution. Now, because we're talking transmission here, if that asset fails the test, so it's not, it's technically not distribution, that means it's transmission. So that, and just to really kind of pare it down, if it fails the test under the seven-factor test, then it is categorized as transmission. Under a separate analysis to determine whether that asset can be integrated with the transmission network, it goes under a separate analysis called the Mansfield test, and we refer to it as a Mansfield test because that is a case that the Federal Commission evaluated and basically came up with this the determination, this evaluation. And again, it's basically used to show that whether, and this is quote from the case, whether any degree of integration by the asset can be used in the backbone transmission system. So that's where Mansfield comes in. And it's a fact-specific test and application. And as this committee is about to go through a very similar fact-specific test and application that the working group has really done a lot of heavy lifting on, that's the standard, that's a criteria here under Mansfield. But recognizing that in Alaska, we are in the rail belt, we are not regulated by the Federal Commission, we also need to be aware that Alaska-specific adjustments may need to be made when applying those lower 48 standards set by the Federal Commission to the Alaska Rail Belt. So, again, we're going to be going into that a little bit more detail here shortly. So I'll kind of make this very quick, but just briefly, this when we're talking about the seven factors in Mansfield, these are the seven factors that are evaluated to determine whether or not the asset is distribution or transmission related. The local distribution facilities, are they normally in close proximity to retail customers? Are those facilities primarily radial in character? Does power flow into local distribution systems? It really, if ever, it flows out. When power enters a local distribution system, it is not recognized or transported on some other market. Does the power entering a local distribution system, is it consumed comparatively in the restricted geographical areas? Are the meters are based at the transmission local interface to measure this output or this flow into the local distribution system? And do local distribution systems, where they be of reduced voltage? That's, again, those very technical criteria that our group really and the technical subgroup did a lot of evaluation on, but that's verbatim. Exactly from the FERC standards on the seven factors. And likewise, the Mansfield factors, they ask more questions more than more statements. The first question is whether these facilities are radial or whether they loop back into the transmission system, whether energy flows only in one direction, like from the transmission system to the customer over the facilities, or do they flow in both directions, from the transmission to the customer and from the customer back to the transmission system. The third is whether the transmission provider is able to provide transmission service to itself or other transmission customers over the facilities in question, whether the facilities provide benefits to the transmission grid in terms of capability or reliability, and whether the facilities can be relied on for coordinated operation of the grid, and whether an outage on the facilities would affect the transmission system. So I think the big question is, again, how do these standards generally apply? So, but we've seen at the working group that the standards promulgated by FERC in any Alaska-specific applications of those standards, again, is fact-intensive and fact-specific. You're looking at the assets themselves and in applying these criteria to assets, and it's, again, fact-specific and fact-intensive. And we're talking about, as we're about to see, a wide range of lines across multiple rail belt entities. There is a significant number of lines that were evaluated under this criteria. And both for this governance committee and the working group, we are constantly in mind that HB 307 in its legislation was clear on what this open access transmission tariff needed to provide for as part of rolling this out. And so this is verbatim language from statute. One is that, which was the overall goal of 307 and this organization, remove impediments to competition in the wholesale bulk electric market. Another is to pool the backbone transmission system costs and allocate them through certificated load-serving entities like the railroad utilities on a coincident peak load ratio share or combination of both. And that is for those who are listening online, those are standard allocation methods that the utilities that are rate regulated are familiar with. So that is criteria that was specifically included just so we had something to go off of. Another one is to account for congestion on the BTS or disruptions that result in isolation for more than 24 hours on the same system, or account for costs to own and operate these backbone transmission system assets. And then finally, pass these costs that are incurred to operate the BTS in a way that's directly and transparent to the railroad utilities customers. So in a way, a line item on a bill or in a way that is very clear to the customers, the end users, just what is the cost of these assets themselves. So it's clear and transparent to the public. So those are provisions that 307 asked, or requires this organization to consider or account for as part of the open access transmission tariff. So for this committee, the considerations from the working group we suggest are really twofold. One, are there Alaska-specific adjustments that need to be made to the application of the FERC standards related to the backbone transmission system in the Alaska Rail Belt? So you're going to hear a lot from the working group and the technical group on the criteria that was used. You know, is that criteria needed to be put in and considered as part of this overall analysis? And of course, the overall larger question is which transmission assets on the rail belt actually qualify to be in the backbone transmission system in a way that they comply with HB 307. So those are the two high level considerations. And to transition to kind of the next two agenda topics here, I just kind of want to share what the working groups, what was the process that we went through in order to come to this point. So a subset of this working group involving a lot of the technical individuals, both from the Railroad Utilities, the Railroad Reliability Council, and Alaska Energy Authority, were tasked with recommending to this committee which facilities fit the statutory BTS definition. And again, they considered the two tests that were referenced earlier in this presentation, the seven-factor test to determine whether or not the asset is distribution or transmission. And then under that criteria, if four or more principles of the seven-factor test were answered yes, the line segment was classified as distribution and was then excluded from the BTS recommendation. Under the Mansfield criteria, again, this is the test that evaluates whether or not these assets are evaluated for integration into the system. If three or more principles underneath that criteria were answered yes, the line segment was deemed included in the BTS recommendation. So it was, again, deemed to be integrated and therefore is a part of the backbone transmission system. So the results of that were that, again, we're looking at a wide range of assets across the rail belt. 127 line segments were evaluated. And under the seven-factor test, 29 segments were unanimously classified as distribution, and then they were excluded from the BTS recommendation. Under Mansfield, then 98 segments were evaluated, with 86 unanimously recommended for inclusion in the BTS. The remaining 12 were not unanimous, but ultimately 11 were recommended for inclusion in the BTS, one was recommended for exclusion. And we're talking only about line segments here, what the policy alludes to, and then I want to make sure it's clear here, is that non-line segment assets are not yet at the recommendation stage. There may be some possible recommendations that have been discussed, but certainly nothing that is on the table for today's discussion and deliberations. And I, John Sinclair from Matanuska Electric, who chaired and led this effort on a technical group, is here to provide any additional information and to, for sure, to answer the more technical questions you may have. But before I transition off, and I just want to show these are the list of line segments that were contested and the recommendation from that technical group. So the 12 assets that were alluded to in the previous slide, here are those assets. And again, 11 of them were ultimately recommended unanimously for inclusion, while one was not. And that concludes my presentation on the BTS, Mr. Chair. All
right. Thank you, Daniel. Any questions on the presentation, on the overview of the BTS presentation?
Just a question. Are we going to have an opportunity to ask some questions a little bit later when we actually vote on the inclusion of that?
Yes, we definitely
okay.
will.
Okay, fair enough. I'll hold my questions.
Okay.
So just a clarifying question. Thank you, Mr. Heckman, for the presentation. It's a lot of work here, and I appreciate that. I did have a question on the application of the seven-factor test and the Mansfield test, just for my understanding. So is the four or more principal threshold for the seven-factor and the three or more principal factor criteria threshold for the Mansfield, are those the FERC guidance for how those criteria are applied, or is that something that was adapted for Alaska?
That was something that was adapted for Alaska.
Okay, thank you. Thanks.
The policy that we're being discussed makes that clear.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Brian?
Sure, thanks. Kind of a follow-on question to that. How were those numbers actually arrived at? Why not 5 or 2 or 1 or?
So I believe that was a technical working group discussion that it was, I'm John, you can correct me, that was almost a product of consensus that was acceptable numbers. 1, maybe 2, too little, but 5 or more too much. This 3 to 5 range for a range that seemed like a acceptable medium.
Was there any dissent on the committee related to that?
John Sinclair, MEA. Yes. So what the process was specifically, we were going to definitely have more than one. If 0 were in, then it wasn't going to cut it. And if 5 were in, then it was definitely in. So the question is, then where in the middle do you end up? Ultimately, we had 127 lines, so the technical working group had to pick something to move forward with. And it was not unanimous. I don't think there was like a vote, but I believe it was like 5 or 6 to 1. I think there was maybe one that wanted to change it. I don't recall. But we moved forward based on the group's, I would say, consensus, but not unanimous, if that makes sense.
Okay, thanks.
Make sure we're taking our name for the record. Oh, that sure. would be really helpful. Thank you.
Brian Hickey. I guess I had another question on the slide related to the Mansfield test. There are a number of terms in here, radio. Is the line radio, or does it affect the system? It says benefit, or does it affect the system, or does it provide benefits? So how did the committee wrestle with those? How did they wrestle with defining those specific things, an effect or a benefit, or what's radial and what's not? I'll go through the chair, circling around here.
And I'm guessing this is going to go right to John, right?
But I'm happy to have you jump in.
Yeah. John Sinclair, MEA. We wrestle with those terms, pulling on definitions from FERC, but even with those definitions, if you read through a lot of the literature throughout the U.S., different people interpret it differently. Even different cases interpret what is a radial differently. So we wrestled with those terms in the technical working group and ultimately came to a consensus, I would say, but not unanimously, on how to move forward with decisions on each individual line. We did pull, obviously, some FERC definitions and try to apply those, but even those definitions are not, there's no mathematical formula that says 2 plus 2 is 4.
Great. I think that's all I have. I'll hold the rest of them until we actually vote.
Arthur.
Okay, thank you. Arthur Miller. I just want to follow up on what Brian was asking. And you look at some of the questions, whether the facilities provide benefits to the transmission grid. I think one could look at it subjectively and say, well, I think it does, and we're going to vote, and it's unanimous on the group. Can you explain what technical analysis was done? So power flow analysis, simulation analysis that justifies the why some of these should be included and why not. And then also, it's universal that the Mansfield test requires at least one criteria to meet the test. Very clear in previous FERC orders. Can you explain, second part of my question, why, what was the basis by which you established different criteria than what's well-established FERC policy?
Yeah, so John Sinclair and me, power flows and studies specifically, it was known that we would need to follow up, and some of those lines are highlighted in yellow, to indicate we should do some follow-up. Given the timeline, we were basing it on our knowledge of the system, and there were actually sub-questions under each one of the principles that helped us define whether or not it should be included or excluded. But there are definitely some follow-up studies that need to be done just given the time constraints. We just based it on our knowledge of the system to move that forward. In regards to, the number, should it be one Mansfield in the affirmative, or one, of the seven factor, the decision to, pick the majority, so 4 or 3, was a discussion amongst the technical working group on how we should proceed specifically for Alaska. There are various cases in the lower 48, and again, no one case is what we used. So you can find cases where one, you can find cases where it doesn't say that you need one. And we discussed, I believe, here at the Governance Committee that we are keeping it somewhat open to the facts of that specific line. We didn't want to lock down a specific number so that we could look at the facts on that line segment. That's also how the policy that we were using is written, is for us to have that, I would say, opportunity to look at each case in each line segment and the facts on that one and determine what we think is appropriate as far as the tests that need to be in the affirmative. Again, at the technical working group, to move this large bulk group forward, we went with that 3 and that 5 to move the bar. So there are multiple cases. They're kind of all over the map. It's hard to get, again, a consensus. It's not like FERC gave, well, if this plus this equals this, then you're in. That's not how those cases are written. So it is not a consensus in the lower 48 how to apply these different tests. I think they keep them pretty wide open so that it can be fact-based for each line segment. That's my interpretation. And that's what the technical working group ultimately went with, was the 4 and the 3, 4 for the 7 factor and 3 for the Mansfield.
So thank you for that. I do think there's differences in interpretation of those FERC orders, and I don't think I've seen anything that deviates from the one factor, minimum one factor. But in any case, as we move forward through the process, I would have you acknowledge there's additional work that needs to be done, additional studies. But let's jump ahead. Let's say we've figured all that out and 5 years goes by and there's modifications to assets that then make a line segment would meet the Mansfield test. So none of this is set in stone in that context. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think as the system gets modified, we definitely have to reassess. New lines get added. Generators will come online. So, I mean, we do long-range studies all the time to see what long-range plans. We update the models. So, yeah, definitely as we modify the system, we should go back and assess.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Brian.
Sure, just another question. Daniel probably going to through the chair to Daniel. It's a ping-pong ball. Could you walk through a little bit the process for the 11 contested lines and how that, how those were decided and how that compared to the decisions that were made on the 86 unanimously included?
John Sinclair again.
Brian Hickey, sorry. That was Brian.
So, yeah, the unanimous ones were fairly easy. You know, we had a set of underneath each and specifically to the Mansfield questions, but this also applied to the seven-factor. Each principal had sub-questions that we were reviewing and either answering yes or no to. The unanimous ones, everybody either answered yes or no, so they were pretty quick and easy. If there was anyone that had any concern on how a utility answered a question, it was marked as not unanimous. And then we went back and discussed, and there were actually more than 12 initially, and we discussed and worked out some of those to get unanimous, but those ultimately we could not get a unanimous yes or no on. And because of that, we then wound up just going around the table and voting and saying, and if you had, you know, the majority of those votes, and we recorded that, and that's how ultimately it either went to a yes for each individual question under each individual principle. And so then you would take the questions, and if the majority of the questions were in the affirmative, then that principle was in. And then if the majority of those principles, then that line was in.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yep. Go ahead, Daniel.
Mr. Miller, just to follow up on your previous question and the discussion, in the policy itself that this committee is about to review, there is a paragraph specifically to, I think, where you were getting at, is that the policy proposes intended to provide that flexibility to argue the inclusion of or the application of the Mansfield criteria, and then to Mr. Seclair's comments, that the facility itself is can be evaluated again in successive opportunities when it's added or inclusion, or if there's significant upgrades or modifications. Of course, this is supposed to provide flexibility to the RTO. So, yes, sir.
Very good. All right, moving on. Thank you for that presentation, Daniel. Moving on to item 8B, the draft backbone transmission system policy. Daniel, I guess I will push that back over to you again.
Yes, so for this committee's consideration, and this has been, as Mr. Sinclair said, this has been brought up a couple of times, but this backbone transmission system policy is being brought forward to this committee to basically, again, really be the guiding document for how we classify the assets for inclusion into the BTS. And again, I'll just kind of point, you know, emphasize the purpose of this policy was, again, to provide that foundation for the technical group to come up with its initial recommendations to this committee. I'm not going to, you know, verbatim read the policy, but again, we do reference the five Mansfield factors And again, to Mr. Miller's previous comment, again, I think the more operable language is in that second paragraph where, again, it says, I'll just quote it verbatim, quote it, the policy is intended to provide flexibility for a transmission owner to argue the appropriate application of the Mansfield test in the Alaska Rail Belt. A transmission facility will be evaluated when it is added and may be re-evaluated for inclusion or exclusion in or from the backbone transmission system if significantly upgraded or modified. So again, this is a policy that's going to guide the evaluation of these facilities or re-evaluation, and that is what is before the governance committee today.
All right. Okay, so we do have a draft policy here for our review, and my understanding would be that if we wanted to solidify this policy to be used for future technical groups, that this group could approve this policy, make modifications of the policy, or potentially say that we don't want to adopt a policy. So open that up for discussion on what is provided, and then I've got some questions, but I will let others jump in first. Yes, Brian, go ahead.
So, Daniel, you read a section in here, and I'm trying to find it. I can't see it now, but provide the flexibility for a transmission owner to argue appropriate application of the Mansfield test. A transmission facility will be evaluated when it is added or may be reevaluated for inclusion or exclusion from the backbone transmission if significantly upgraded or modified. Does that particular phrasing prohibit someone who might disagree with the results of the analysis that was done by the technical working group from addressing that in front of the commission? It sounds like it's only if they were upgraded or if it's new. But my understanding was different than that, and I just would like some clarification on that.
So this is Daniel Heckman, Golden Valley, and John, feel free to correct. But my impression is that nothing prohibits any entity of the RTO to avail themselves of going before the RCA and the commission and making an argument on the asset itself and why Mansfield may have been applied from their perspective, not in a proper way, but nothing prohibits entities from availing themselves of going to the RCA to make that
for new, upgraded, or the existing.
Correct.
Okay, yes. I just wanted to make sure that was clear. Thank you.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Joel.
And I actually fixated on the same sentence that this is Joel Groves with the RSC. Sorry, same sentence that Brian Hickey just questioned there, and I'm wondering. So this sentence says, you know, significantly upgraded or modified, and I'm wondering, could the usage of the BTS evolve over time where the usage of an asset would change, and that would change the criteria of whether or not it was considered a backbone asset? So let's say you have some transmission radial that was excluded from the backbone subset. Something evolves over time where the asset hasn't been physically changed, but its usage crosses that backbone threshold and it needs to be reevaluated. Should this language anticipate that and include that potential? And if that did happen, is there a process defined yet? I guess this is more generally, is there a process defined yet by which assets or parties can petition for assets to be included in the BTS definition, be it members of this board or just, you know, non-RTO entities that say, you know, hey, I think this thing should be part of the BTS. Is there a mechanism where they can petition that? Thanks.
All right. Well, John?
Thanks. John Sinclair, MEA. My impression of what the language here is stating is if the usage, as you said, say a new generation facility was at the end of that line, and that would trigger an evaluation following this process to determine whether or not that asset would ultimately end up as part of the BTS. It wouldn't de facto put it in or out. You'd have to go through this, but any large generating facility at the end of a radial, it would have to, that if the generation facility wasn't there initially, we would want to evaluate it. But again, this is designed to be somewhat flexible. It didn't want to put specific numbers or dates or anything. It's pretty open-ended. It would probably come to this body to take a look and say, yeah, let's move forward or not.
Just kind of a follow-on, Brian Hickey from Seward. A follow-on to Joel's question. You know, earlier when you were responding to Mr. Miller's questions, you seemed to imply that there was a flexibility to modify the number of Mansfield tests that had to be passed. That's what I heard you say. And are you saying that if we brought in a new line segment or a different, for some reason, some other configuration, that the committee has the flexibility to say, well, you know, I think with this particular one, if you pass one, you're in. Is that what you were saying, or is it some? Because you then said, well, we picked three because we just needed to move the bar forward, and we didn't really have a technical reason for that. We just had to pick a number. That's what I heard you say, and I'm just kind of trying to drill down on that a little bit.
Yeah, John Sinclair. So the policy is flexible. You're correct. So it does put the one. You need one. You need five. But anywhere in between, it is based on the facts of that specific line segment. The working group determined for the current lines that we have, we were going to use the four and the three. So that was blanketed across all of the existing ones. A new one could make the determination that we want to use two, but the technical working group for the current ones, but you're correct. There's nothing in here that requires us to use three or four or two. It does say you got to have one and five, but there's nothing in here that says a number other than those.
Great. Thank you.
Yep, Arthur.
Arthur Miller. Real quick, John and Daniel, appreciate the discussion. So did the working group contemplate the process by which a transmission asset, if there was an upgrade to it, on how that would be incorporated into the OAT? That is to say, were you thinking of it in the context that if a utility had a modification to its system such that they believed a transmission segment should be included in the OAT, would that be done through the utility's filing with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska in the determination of the transmission revenue requirement, or would that be done under a separate process by which the utility would go to the RTO first and go through a process there? Was there any discussion about process?
I can take that, and then you can Daniel Hickman going by. I just think this may be the technical group definitely might have gone a little bit deeper. I just know from that is an issue that the legal and regulatory team and the broad working group has talked about, and I know we're having another discussion down the even today, I think, even as a touch on how do we incorporate and discuss new facilities with everything going on with the grip build out and other things. I think from a process standpoint right now, Mr. Miller, from where I believe this committee, this organization would be the proper forum for us including, seeking inclusion of any new upgrades or modifications of those facilities into the broader BTS, because that is what I think the organization is stood up for, and that is what it's charged to do. I mean, the commission always serves as the ultimate backstop. I mean, this organization is subject to a CPCN that the commission just certificated. So there's always that backstop. But I believe that the position is that this committee would be the first arena of having that kind of dialogue and inclusion or exclusion discussion before going to the RCA. The OAT would then have to be modified appropriately. It would be a living filing, that document that we would have to provide updates to the commission on from the RTO's perspective. I believe it would be more RTO driven than utility specific driven.
Follow up on that? No. Joel.
Yeah, Joel Groves with the RRC. My recollection in the RTO's bylaws is that they do specifically state that this committee approves the BTS asset list. So, you know, consistent with Mr. Heckman's comments, then that would somehow come before this committee to make those decisions and approve those decisions. And then it would flow to the OAT and RCA tariff filings and whatnot. So I think that's all correct. Thanks.
Yep, Ben, do you guys have any problems with that? Regarding the Lower 48 process.
So the NEA representative?
Yeah, John?
Yeah.
Yeah, John Sinclair. John Childs is a consultant that we've been working with going through the process. He does have some insight. He's familiar with what's been done in the Lower 48. So because he's been helping with the process, that's why he's on. And if there were specific questions on how this process is done in the Lower 48, he's available to chime in with his experience. That's why he's on.
Just a point. He's not been attending the meetings, and this has been a conversation of the governance committee. And I just don't know if we're taking comments from the audience or for participants on the phone. I just don't know if we want to do that. I don't. But it's a process. You know. Then we're going to be opening ourselves up. So maybe if you could reach out and understand what he's. Wants to comment on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's online, right?
He's on that Teams meeting, so.
Yeah, John, maybe at the break, if you can touch base with them.
Yeah, I can touch base with them.
We'll determine whether we want to move forward with that or not. So, yeah, thank you. So, John, one question I had for you in regards to this document. So, I think it lays out the Mansfield and the seven factor pretty well, and you had mentioned that there are subsets of questions within each of these to help determine whether it was a yes or no for those. Looking at this being kind of a high-level document, is there another technical document that the technical working group would keep as a solidification for future evaluations of lines that break down those subsets of questions for each one of these so that, you know, if the current technical working group is not here, that at least the new folks coming in would say, oh, this is the process we follow. Because if you're just looking at this particular policy, it doesn't break it down to that level of granularity.
Yeah, John Sinclair, we do have a document, a large spreadsheet, and it has all of the questions. It also has details on any of the dissents and why. So it's pretty well documented what the process was, so that could be handed off if current group moves on and there's new members of the technical working group. I don't plan to do anything to that document, so yeah, that would be something I would highly recommend that whoever comes on board would utilize. Okay. So those records are kept.
Okay, thank you. Just wanted to make sure that there was some reference to how these determinations were made for future reference as well. Okay. Anything else on the policy? And I guess the question is for this group is, are there any recommendations for modifications to the existing policy that's before us? And if not, is this group comfortable with moving forward with a vote on accepting the policy?
So John Sinclair, MEA, I would recommend that footnote 8 be removed, and I don't know if that needs to be in a motion or and the reason for that is footnote 8 does reference a affirmative of just one of the Mansfield, and per our discussion and per what the policy has, I think that we should keep it definitely more than one. And so if it's zero, you're out, and if it's five, you're in. But I don't, at least my reading of this says it can be anywhere from two to four is basically where we're discussing. And so I think having a reference, a footnote that says the one kind of implies, well, one and you're in, and that's, I don't think what the intent of this policy was. I think the intent was to allow anything between two and greater than one, at least one, and definitely if you have fives. So that's my recommendation, is to remove footnote 8 to keep this as broad and open as possible.
So for a point of order, maybe what we can do is we can make a motion to accept the policy as it's drafted, and then we can make amendments to that however we see fit. So if we want to put this on the table, if we can make a motion to approve it, and then we can have those discussions.
Curtis there, AEA, I make a motion that we accept the backbone transmission system. I guess we don't really have a title on this, but the policy...
Let's call it the backbone transmission system policy.
Yeah, the backbone transmission policy.
Second, Hickey.
Okay. All right. With that, we will open that up for discussion.
Yeah.
Do you want to make your recommendation for a change or a modification to the document?
Yeah, John Sinclair, MEA. I'd recommend an amendment to remove footnote 8.
Okay.
Just a second.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Second. For discussion purposes.
Yep. On the table for discussion now.
So you said a couple things there in your discussion on it. You said it needed two. You thought this policy said it needed two, and then near the end you said you thought it needed one.
Sorry, I misspoke, John Sinclair. I misspoke if I said it needed two. It needs at least one, right? Zero, it would not be included. So I apologize if I said two. That wasn't what I was trying to communicate, but yeah, at least one, and if it had five, obviously it'd be in. If it had zero, it'd be out. So somewhere in the middle. I just don't want to imply that if you have one, you're definitely in. And that case reference had that one, so I think it'd be appropriate to remove the footnote 8.
Brian,
following. So in removing this. There's no intent or implication from your perspective that someone couldn't argue that this case was applicable. We're not setting a precedent here that, well, we pulled it out because we didn't think it mattered. If, for example, you want to go down to the commission and make the case that this is that is the standard that FERC set, your intent is to take it out because it's not consistent with the three. Or what? Yeah, maybe I'm not following why you're taking it out. If you could explain that, articulate that a little more clearly for me.
Yeah. So John Sinclair. So the footnote just implies that if you have one, then you're in. And I don't think the policy implies that. It's trying to say it could be one, it could be two, it could be three, it could be four.
Okay. So it becomes a case of facts before the commission.
Right.
Okay. Arthur.
Arthur Miller. So going back to the footnote and my interpretation of the need for the footnote really is we're defining any degree of integration in that sentence, in that paragraph. So by removing that footnote, that leaves open to any degree of integration interpretation. And really, if you look at the legislation, it's very specific and says consistent with FERC. And that's exactly how we're applying, at least on this definition. And this is a very recent order, and there's even more recent orders, even in this year, substantiating how they interpret it. So I'm opposed to taking that footnote out. I think the legislation is very clear, and this reaffirms that we are being consistent with the legislation that was written, and it does define any degree of integration. It's in quotes in that first sentence, and that's the basis for the definition in footnote number 8. Thanks.
So, John, just a question. Travis Million with Golden Valley. Is part of your recommendation or request as well is that, as you discussed, Alaska is unique and different than the lower 48. So trying to define things exactly as they do in the lower 48 would not necessarily be applicable to Alaska. So are you saying that also part of the reason for selecting three of the Mansfield when you guys went through your evaluation is kind of that Alaska factor that, you know, we don't necessarily meet everything. I mean, our grid is unique compared to the lower 48.
Yeah, John Sinclair, that certainly was considered. We are different. We're trying to fit as much as possible FERC application, but there are unique circumstances. We do have a unique grid. So everything isn't going to fit just like FERC. So you've got to take that into consideration, trying to be as clear as possible in the policy, but still leave it open so that we have some leeway in what we want to do. There's a balance there. And I can understand different viewpoints. Our viewpoint is that the footnote 8 makes it, in MEA's opinion, a little unclear. That's why we're recommending taking it out. And we did at the technical working group decide to move forward with something that was different than what footnote 8 references. I can understand there's different viewpoints. Again, we aren't FERC. We aren't the lower 48. There are some differences. How do we thread that needle? And our recommendation is to remove it.
Right. Sure. In you said that there are unique circumstances that got you to the three. What were they? What was unique about the rail belt that said three was better than one?
Well, I don't think there's any specific, if you're referring to a technical, like, we should definitely use three. The preponderance of evidence usually indicates more than, 50%. And so the three, as discussed in the technical working group, was a good guide for putting that three principles, more than 50%, moving that forward. So when we looked at the language, the preponderance of evidence, we thought three was a good bar to use to move it across the finish line.
So there was no technical justification for that. It was really to move the process forward.
And I think you'll see when you look at a lot of the documentation, even in FERC, there's you can have, what's the capacity on the line? There's a thermal rating, there's physics, there's a mathematical formula. But then when you look at the language and the interpretation of the language, kind of like radial, well, we can argue quite a bit about what you think a radial is, and we can use different language, but ultimately it's going to come down to what does each individual think and each utility think should be appropriate, and that's what we wound up doing. So, no, I don't have a mathematical formula for you other than we hit the three, and that's what the technical working group came to as a conclusion to move this forward. But if you're looking for a formula, I don't, or a technical, well, we calculated this line's capacity and we thought that it was this. I don't have that. It was the three was the preponderance based on the language in here, more than 50%. That's what we thought how we would move forward.
Sure. I wasn't looking for a formula. You just said there were unique circumstances in the rail belt that justified a deviation from FERC, and I was asking what those unique circumstances were.
Well, and again, I don't think that you're saying a deviation from FERC, and I don't believe there was a deviation from FERC. You look at FERC, and there's different cases, and they aren't explicitly saying you need zero or you need one or you need two or you need three in every single case. This case cited that, but there are other cases that leave it very open.
Okay.
So
that's really that was what I was trying to get to.
Yeah, so you can't, I mean, this is definitely a case that was ruled on, but you can pull other cases that were provided to, I think, this group too, where it is very open-ended on what the ruling is, and it more went to, hey, let's look at this line in this situation, not necessarily how many of the Mansfield passed. So, again, it is pretty open, and that's why citing a specific case, and, yeah, in that case, for those facts, the one Mansfield, they felt, yep, that works. But you look at other cases, and it's very different.
Can I just, one last, I don't mean to dominate. One last and I'll stop. This is for Daniel. And I just want to reaffirm that an objective of this policy was to give some level of guidance to the technical working group, but also to create a level of ambiguity such that individuals who disagreed with interpretation, such as 3 out of 5, 1 out of 5, 2 out of 5, could take that to the regulatory commission in a public process and have that be decided by the commission as a case of facts before that commission.
Yes, Daniel Heckman with Golan Valley, that's correct. That's
okay,
correct.
Thank you.
I know that there were cases presented, but I don't think those cases support what you were saying, Mr. Sinclair. But I will leave it at that, and I think I know how I'm going to vote on this, so I'm good to go. Thank you.
Any other discussion on this topic? So right now we have an amendment to the original motion, and that amendment is to remove footnote number 8 from the policy that was presented. So with that, we will go to a vote on the amendment that is on the table. So
can I have a point of information quickly? So a couple of questions. I didn't read the bylaws this morning, so I don't recall what it is. Not for the amendment, but for the policy approval, what is the vote threshold for that? Is it simple majority, or was there a higher vote threshold in the bylaws?
I think it was a simple majority, but we should.
We don't have all the. I don't
think. We got a room full of attorneys. I think they're all.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm waiting for head nods or something here.
I think it's a simple answer based on the bylaws. I don't know what it is.
This is Tina. You guys can hear me.
Oh, Tina, yes. Okay. Tina.
So basically, it's an affirmative vote, except for those matters that expressly require alternate voting. It's 4 or more, and the ones that we have that require at least 5 are the bylaws and subsequent amendments or removal of an officer, and unanimous for dispute resolution. So I believe those are the only ones called out in the bylaws, therefore it would be a simple majority.
Excellent. Thank you, Tina, for that clarification. I do remember that there was a higher threshold, but I couldn't remember what it was for, so the bylaws and removal of officer.
Could we do a roll call vote, I think?
Absolutely, yeah. So, Jennifer, if we could do a roll call vote, please.
Just clarify, a yes removes it, a no keeps it.
A yes would remove it and approve the amendment. Yes.
It's just for
the amendment to remove number 8, footnote number 8.
Okay. Two Deaf Electric Association?
No, opposed to removing footnote number 8.
The City of Seward?
Subject to my ability to argue this for the commission, I'll go along with removing it from the actual policy.
Sarah Lamb, yes.
Matanuska Electric Association.
John Sinclair, yes.
Golden Valley Electric Association.
Travis Million, yes.
Curtis Sayer.
AEA, yes. AEA, yes.
The motion carries here.
Okay, so now the motion that is on the table for the modified policy, and this would be to approve the policy as amended with the last motion. So if we could do a roll call vote on that as well. So a yes vote would be to adopt the policy as amended.
The City of Seward?
Yes.
Homer Electric Association?
No.
Matanuska Electric Association?
Yes.
Travis Million, yes.
Alaska Energy Authority?
Curtis Thayer, yes.
Two Gas Electric
Authority. Arthur Miller, I will vote yes, and I'll leave it there with the understanding that we can make our appropriate arguments, as Mr. Hickey indicated earlier.
Okay. Thank you, Jennifer. All right, before we move on to item 8C, I'm going to call for a 5-minute break as instructed by Mr. Hickey on my left before we started the meeting.
So you're 5 minutes so late.
We're going to try to keep up with that today and take regular scheduled breaks because it'll be a very long day. So.
Okay, Chair, you're back on the record.
All right, thank you, Jennifer. Okay, so that brings us to item 8C, the composition of the backbone transmission system for the Alaska Rail Belt. So, Daniel, I'm going to kick that over to you, but I know you're going to push that over to the technical group right away.
Yes. With the committee's indulgence, I will just pass this on to Mr. Sinclair, and this is the technical aspect of the BTS discussion, so I will pass it on to John to set us up for the next steps here.
Yeah, thank you, Daniel, John Sinclair, MEA. So I believe in your packet, I'm going through all the paperwork right now, but there is a list of line segments that are recommended for the backbone transmission system. Going through following the backbone transmission policy, I think that's what we named it. Following that process, we did have a pretty lengthy discussion on that process. This was the end result from the technical working group on what the technical working group believes is the backbone transmission system. And before you is that recommendation to include those lines. Of course, this will affect the ATRR and what actual facilities will be included in the RTO. So I'm happy to take any questions on the process. We did discuss it earlier, but we can go in depth more or however you guys want to proceed with it. But before you is that list going through seven-factor, then going through the Mansfield, and ultimately selecting these line segments as a recommendation to this body to vote on.
Well, Joel?
Joel Groves with the RRC. A simple question. So I don't know what any of the FACID codes mean as to, like, which segment they are. And I understand that you get into critical energy infrastructure information if you have too much of this in the public domain, but I'm curious if there is a map that perhaps, like, you know, has in one color, you know, an 8.5 by 11 rail belt, you know, entire rail belt map. Color one is it's in, color two is it's out, and then maybe you just label the line segments that are out so that would facilitate, I mean, my understanding, which isn't super critical, but also the public understanding of what this product is.
So, John Sinclair, we do have that map. It was not included in the public documentation, but that map is available. Kind of like that they're circled what's out, but it does line out all the different facilities and what is in and out. We just didn't include it in the public documentation.
But to follow up on, I think, where you're this is Daniel Heckman, by the way, to follow up on, I think, on where you're getting at, Joel, when we filed with the RCA our certificate docket and the pre-certificate docket, we understand that they will be looking for a map, essentially, of whatever is ultimately adopted here that we would have to submit as part of our OAT filing. So the map itself will eventually ultimately become a public document.
Okay, thank you.
Question for you, John. So we've got the spreadsheets here. It's up on the screen for those that are online as well. So of these documents, do we have the ones listed that did not meet? Because you were going through, I believe in your presentation that talked about, or maybe it was Daniel's presentation, there was a number of them that immediately were thrown out. Yes, there we go. And so I guess my question is do we want to be going through first and take the easier one to say, you know, do we need to approve the ones that did not get thrown in, or do we want to work on accepting the ones that were unanimous, that there was no contention, and then focus on the ones, the 12, I guess, that were in the presentation? So I guess what's the will of the body for how we want to proceed with discussing these and approving the line segments?
If I could just, so all of them ultimately wound up that were contested wound up in except for one line. I don't know if that helps, but all of them ultimately wound up in of the 89 or 98, sorry, those reversed. But all of them wound up in but one. So we can definitely go through all of them that were contested or whatever the body wants to do, but ultimately all of them but one wound up not moving forward. So however we want to proceed.
Brian?
Sure, Brian Dickey from Seward. I guess my thinking is that in total, these two sheets represent the recommendation of the technical working group to the working group and the working group to the governance committee. Am I accurate in that? The sheet that says, I'll identify them for the record. FERC seven-factor test evaluation, that identifies the lines that were immediately dropped as distribution. I mean, that's a question.
So, Daniel Heckman, I just may want to just clarify kind of what I think I heard you say, Mr. Hickey. So the technical working group, this is through the working group, but the broader working group that consists of both technical and non-technical individuals, we basically, for the clearinghouse, we didn't come in and do any sort of intermediate analysis. This is purely from the technical aspect.
Perfect. Thank you. And I think that kind of goes to where I'm going with my point. I will get into it here eventually. and then the second document, Mansfield test evaluation, is the lines that were included in the backend transmission system. And together, this is the recommendation of the technical working group. And I guess I would propose that we approve or disapprove the entire recommendation of the technical working group. And I say that because given the information we have and the confidential nature of critical infrastructure, we really don't have the ability in this body to look at what MEA 00014 is. I know as much about the railroad as anybody, and I don't know what that is. So I would propose that we take the recommendation in whole, or if we have a disagreement with it, send it back to the committee for further analysis. That's my thinking.
I would prefer that we have a group that we've agreed upon, that's been agreed upon, that we discuss those. There's 11 that's outstanding, and we can address those one-on-one. That way 90% of them get to move forward, and we can ask some questions on the ones that are outstanding. Because if we do it in bulk, I will vote no. But if we have a chance to ask questions on those 11, I might be able to get there on those 11 and ask the questions. I just don't want to hold up progress, and it's a lot of work, so I'd like to get the 89 or whatever, get those moving forward if we have it. Yeah.
So if I'm hearing you right, Curtis, just for clarification, that you'd be fine if we were to make a motion to approve the 86 unanimous ones, and then we will then make a motion to discuss the...
I won't predict the outcome of the vote, but
yeah,
I would like to move those...
Assuming that was the case.
Yes.
Okay, I just want to make sure I was clear with what you were stating.
Sure, so this clarity, the 11 that were approved are in this document, so it's not either of these that were approved.
The 11 we would hold for questions.
Right, but they are in this document. Right. So I guess what I'm trying to ask, a point of order or a point of process.
Earlier we had a list of line segments contested. That list of 11, I would like to better understand those 11.
Okay. Thanks.
So I guess I'd be looking potentially for a motion to get this on the table to approve the, let me get the numbers right, the 86 unanimously non-contested line segments. For approval, and then we can see where that goes, if that makes sense.
So moved, Hickey.
Okay. Is there a second on that?
Arthur Miller, second.
Okay. Any discussion regarding the 86 unanimous non-contested line segments for approval? Okay. Hearing none. Do we want to go ahead and do a roll call vote, or is there a preference?
I think that this is just me. Mm-hmm. Considering I think some of these might be an issue later down the road, we probably should have a roll call vote.
Okay.
Just to make sure everybody's voice is heard.
I would agree with that. All right. Jennifer, if we could do a roll call vote with the motion that's on the table.
Yes, sir. Homer Electric Association?
Sarah Lamb, no.
Matanuska Electric Association?
John Sinclair, yes.
Golden Valley Electric Association?
Travis Million, yes.
Alaska Energy Authority?
Curtis Thayer, yes.
Scotch Electric Association?
Arthur Miller, yes.
The City of Seward?
Brian Hickey, yes.
The motion carries, Chair.
Okay, thank you. All right, now that would bring us to the remaining 11 segments that were contested, but presented to us for recommendation. So if we wanted to put a motion on the table for approval of these, and then we can open it up for discussion.
So moved, Hickey.
I'll second for discussion.
Okay. We're open for discussion. Curtis, if you had anything you wanted to bring up.
I have the question on the Seward lines and would like to just better understand how Seward met the Mansfield test criteria, since Seward is a customer of Chugach and rarely moves power, and the power they receive goes to Seward and does not go out to Seward. So I just want to better understand that those lines with Seward.
John Sinclair, MEA. Those specific lines and on here, they're the SES lines, were definitely debated. There was lots of discussion on the different Mansfield tests and whether or not they met them. There was a pretty solid split vote depending on the specific question, and it actually varied ultimately. So those were challenging lines. So you're not alone wondering how that ultimately moved in. My recollection was there was consideration on Black Start. There was discussion in some of the questions. Sub-questions under the Mansfield principles had to do with Black Start. That was one of the key discussions that I think wound up moving some members of the technical working group into the, yep, it does have Black Start capability. There's also power flows that do occur both directions more than, I'm going to say, every 10 years, because that was kind of a point. They do occur, you know, is it regular? Again, we get into these nuances of, you know, what is regular? How often does Seward push power out? And does that validate them as being included? So there's some questions in there that were debated on Black Start, power flows in both directions or a single direction. How often do you need to flow that power? And ultimately, the committee decided to move in favor of including them. But those two were probably the closest by far. It was pretty split. And it came down to how do you decide some of those key questions like bidirectional power flow. Well, if it happens once a month, once a year, once every 2 years, does that mark it as a yes? Mm-hmm. Black Star capable? Yes, they are. So should that be considered? Because those were some of the questions. So that's kind of how it fell. That's at a very high level. We can dive into specific questions, but it definitely comes down to, you know, how do you interpret bidirectional power flow and how often, for example. That's just one example of one question.
It may be, how often does Seward produce power and put it on the rail belt? Do you say some 10 years or?
So, John Sinclair, so there was an example for Golden Valley where they have some DOD facilities that do have backup generation that technically are capable of moving on to the grid, but rarely, and that's where the once every 10 years came in. So it was considered by the group, once every 10 years is probably not adequate to say bidirectional. But then you get into when is it bidirectional, and that was – the question, I don't know how often. It was more than every 10 years that Seward does it, but I defer to Brian.
And it might be helpful to maybe pull up the spreadsheet where we answered each of those questions if you wanted to go through all the sub-questions and understand them. But, for example, today Seward is serving Moose Pass load of Chugaches, right? So during contingency outages on the transmission line or the distribution lines, we feed Moose Pass, and 3 weeks ago, when the transmission line was out of service, Seward Generation is feeding Chugach load out of Moose Pass, for 3 days while we put the transmission line up after last windstorm. That happens on a fairly regular basis. In addition, monthly, you know, Seward has 15.6 megawatts of generation. On a monthly basis, we test run that generation, and at that point in time, sometimes we run it above our load and sometimes below our load. So sometimes we're pushing power into the grid and sometimes we're not. That happens on a monthly basis. Those units are also black start units. So they are available when the system is down. We black start Seward on a regular basis, but we can also be a black start for the Kenai Island as it starts to come up in working in combination with Cooper Lake during different islanding scenarios where, for example, when we had the southern tie out south of Quartz Creek and we had the line out north of.
Just for clarification, Seward is 69 kV?
No, Seward is 115 to Lawing and then 69.
Okay.
Although we are in the process of converting the entire system to 115.
Okay.
We have the transformers purchased and design is 65%. So by June of next year, the entire Seward system will be 115 kV.
Okay.
Real quick, but so this question for Brian. So even the line delivery point will be at 115?
Yeah. No, it'll step down to 24.9 there. The line will be a tap off the 115. Right now, there's a 69 to 115 transformer, a three-winding transformer there. We've taken that out. We've bought a 115 to 24.9 transformer. So Primrose and Crown Point and Moose Pass would, when we're closed on 4101, would actually be fed at 24.9 from the 115 system.
Okay, got it. Thank you. Another question. I don't want to interrupt that. Brian, are you still?
No, I think, further? You know, but we could go through the questions if that would help, Curtis. All the sub-questions.
I'll do the questions.
Sub-questions.
I've read the questions.
Oh, okay.
I've read the sub-questions.
Okay.
I guess I would like to get maybe further information on the Cooper line, the 69 kV line from Cooper Power Plant to the 115 line, and maybe give some background information on that and how it was determined. Then it not be included. Really a similar question that Curtis asked, but just in the context of Cooper Lake.
Yeah.
Power plant.
John Sinclair here. That was another contested, I would say those three, the Cooper and the two Seward, were probably the ones where the votes were split the most. The rest of them were pretty close to unanimous. There was like one dissenter. So for Cooper, I think the distinction in that Cooper, for clarification, is the one no. So that one, a distinction was City of Seward has both load and generation, whereas Cooper specifically was considered just a generation lead, if you will. So only generation. And I think that is, when you look at some of the specific questions under each principle, really moved it into the category of being excluded. There's questions on wholesale and retail, and really none of those apply to Cooper. You aren't feeding out of there a retail or wholesale. So the distinction, when you get down into the questions, that distinguishes Cooper from Seward was the load that Cooper just doesn't have. It's a generation lead, basically. And so when you filter through the questions, ultimately, it did not pass, I believe, ultimately, any of the Mansfield. So it wound up. And I could be wrong. Ryan was like, it's one. I think when the votes came in, it was zero. Before that, it had one. But when we voted, it wound up being that zero of the Mansfield. But I'll double check to make sure my numbers are right. But that was the distinction to answer your question.
But no technical production cost modeling, if you will, or runs were made to look at the reliability impacts associated with that power plant being online or not online, and black start capabilities and so forth, and impacting reliability of power transfers on the 115 line, if that analysis had been done.
You're correct. No analysis. We didn't do studies. So you're correct. Kind of getting back to our previous conversation, definitely leave the door open in the future for studies. And some of those lines were highlighted to, hey, we should go back and study them. But with that said, there are questions that definitely talk about black start. They talk about, you know, is it helping the stability of the grid? So it got some, I'm going to say marks or positives on some of those questions, but you've got to look at all of the questions as a whole and whether or not those questions then sum up to more than 50%, because it varied depending on each principal, how many questions were under it, whether or not that principal got an affirmative, and then ultimately whether there was three or more of the principal for that line to be in. So while it got an affirmative on some of the questions for grid support, as you mentioned, ultimately it got enough no's on those questions, on the other questions, to exclude it. So it's not just one item, right? There's quite a bit that actually went into that.
Sarah?
I'm just curious, I guess, in looking at, I know you've brought up a couple times, Arthur, power supply or power flow studies with regards to the evaluation of these lines. Are we at all setting ourselves up for discrimination if we try to employ studies to make the determination when we did not do that with the initial set of transmission assets that we're considering for inclusion? So in the future, if we have another party that comes to the table and would like to interconnect and have their assets evaluated, are we comfortable using this process, or are we going to be leaning on, because we will have more time in the future, on some of these more like engineering-based studies for the evaluation of any new lines? I'm just, as a general question.
I don't know who's going to answer that question.
Is Tina here?
I'll take a stab at it.
Okay. Brian, I'll let you take a stab.
I think that from a technical perspective, you could study most of the lines. You know, they're basically, and we do that. We haven't done it for this purpose, but, you know, I think there are 1,101 single contingencies in the rail belt. And the way you do that, and we've done it many times, you look at Summer Valley and Summer Peak and Winter Peak. And Summer Valley will give you your stability limits. The Summer Peak will give you your thermal limits. And the Winter Peak will give you your voltage problems. And that's a function of the physics. So the rail belt has run those 1,100 contingencies. And so the 89 that we know are no-brainers. We know that because we've studied it. And I guess we could, as a matter of course, this committee could say, go back and run that study for this purpose. Rerun it again, just so you have a document that said I did that. I don't think that's a bad idea. The ones that were questioned, I think if you ran those studies, they will all be in. In fact, I know they will because I've run the studies before. but the people who were at the table didn't know that, and so they made choices based on kind of best available information. I don't think it's a bad idea to say, let's go back and study these. And I think when you do that, you'll find that basically the whole rail belt is the backbone, because we're so lightly interconnected and so small that everything has an effect on the stability. But maybe I think that might be an assignment from the RTO to the technical working group to execute on that, and then use that information to update this when we get the study work done. And then we are on solid footing as other folks come in.
Arthur.
Agree 100% with Mr. Hickey. I also want to add, you know, there was given a very limited time to evaluate these transmission assets, and I think the working group did an outstanding job in advancing, you know, a significant amount of the transmission segments that really didn't need any further evaluation from a technical perspective. But then we've isolated, you know, areas that, well, maybe additional work could be needed. Very reasonable from my perspective, and I think that we're moving the ball in the right direction as we move forward. And I don't think that anybody here is saying, no, we're shutting the door against any additional analysis that needs to happen. I think we're saying the opposite. So I like the approach that we're doing, and I think that we've made really good determinations on what assets are included, and not having to do extensive further analysis on those, with recognition there may be some additional work and evaluation that will need to be done. And certainly with new transmission lines, that evaluation will take place and evaluated, you know, as appropriate.
Yeah, a couple points. I agree with Arthur on the fact that we are under a very restricted deadline by the law itself, by HB 307. So it's not the utilities or the governance committee. It's the actual issue of the law. Just two quick questions. One's a short follow-up, and that is you made reference to Moose Pass being Chugach customers. I thought they actually received their bills from Seward Electric. So Moose Pass is Chugach. Okay.
Primrose and Crown Point south of Moose Pass are.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
okay. I just wasn't sure where the demarcation was. I guess this is more for the working group, and that was consideration or including these 11 contested lines. Was there concern that this would allow for the RTO to allow generation leads for IPPs into the system in the future? Was that a conversation? Was that a topic?
Just from Daniel Heckman, Director Thayer, for my understanding, yes, the considerations of IPPs and in future, you know, in future could mean like imminent versus down the road. That was
right.
A part of the discussion. You know, I kind of looked to John to see just how much of a factor that really went into the final analysis. But of course, both at the working group levels and at the various levels, the presence of IPPs and how they fit into this equation has been discussed. But I'll let John maybe do a follow-up more to specific to the technical group.
Yeah, so John Sinclair here. From the technical group, while there's definitely outside factors, we really tried to look specific at each individual question and just answer that question as unbiasedly as possible.
Right,
so I don't want to say there was no consideration of that, but we really just focused, okay, here's the principle, here are the questions for this, and jumping off of what Mr. Hickey was saying, we do a lot in that group, have done studies in the past, have looked at the system, and so we were basing it on our historical knowledge, making those decisions, but I think it's always great to do additional studies to back that up. So totally agree, but we were basing it on historical studies and really focusing on the questions. With the questions and the principles that were given and the analysis done, it tends to lead to excluding generation leads from the BTS. That is how the technical structure is set up right now. I don't want to judge how anybody was biased, but just looking at the questions, it tends to lead to not including generation leads, just based on the questions. And I think that's how the Mansfield, looking at it and looking at the questions, that's how it was set up. But, again, we just tried to focus on the questions. But that was the end result.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Brian? Yeah, I just wanted to clarify two things. One, when I said all lines would be in the BTS, that's an overstatement. There are a handful of lines that would not be in the BTS. But we know those lines, but and they aren't necessarily the ones that came out of this analysis. The second point, I wasn't proposing that we do these studies before July 1st. I think as an ongoing task for the RTO, it would be worth our while to go back and validate what we did under this short time frame and you know, reach agreement with the technical studies to back it up. I think that would be a worthwhile exercise. So that was what I was saying. If you interpret, I thought maybe you interpreted, I would say do it before July 1st.
No.
That I'm not
just
saying.
Want clarification.
Yeah.
It is not this body that's, we all agree they should be done. It's
yes.
Just we don't physically have the time to do it based on the statute.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I totally concur. So.
Yeah, I just wanted that on the record that the statute is governing our timeline.
Perfect. One further question. So this is on the, really with respect to Seward. And right now in on the numbers, it's only the 115 line from Dave's Creek to Seward that's included, right?
Yeah, it's the as they're listed, because right now it's still at 69, so it's a 115 from Dave's to Long and 69 from Dave's to Fort Ray are included. The 115 tap to Spring Creek is excluded.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, so it's two of the three line segments, or two are in and one is out. Next June, it will be a single 115 line from Dave's to Fort Ray, and Lawing will just be a tap. So it will be as you are stating it right now.
Yep.
As soon as we get the Nass Road Phase 2 completed.
Yep. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? So, John, just clarification from my standpoint. So, as we were talking about the CEA 25 line that did not pass. So, there's been a lot of discussion on the Mansfield, whether it should be one, should it actually follow three, like the technical committee had gone on. And I think I heard you say that particular line meant zero. And so I just wanted to confirm that and kind of clarify that, if it was one or three, it wouldn't have mattered in this case because it did not meet any of the Mansfield test requirements.
Yeah, John Sinclair here. So before we did a vote on that one, it did have one in. After the vote, it had zero in. So the final tally was zero. I think that was the confusion because initially it did have one in, and after voting, it did have zero in.
Okay, thank you. Any other discussion on this topic? Okay, so right now we do have a motion on the table for the approval of the 11 line segments that we've been discussing here that were contested. Yes, Brian.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm realizing now that the line segments that are excluded, we don't have a list of those. We have the seven factor ones, but not a list of the excluded ones. Okay, that's really what I was going to ask for, is that we have that list. So I probably have it here somewhere in my office.
So, John Sinclair here. Just to clarify, that basically these two spreadsheets indicate the yes votes. So, for distribution, so if you go to the seven factor, what you see under the seven factor is what we voted yes, which means it's distribution, which means it's excluded. So, your seven factor are lines that are excluded. And then going to the beach, to the Mansfield, again, it's a yes, which means it's in. So the one additional one that isn't in either one of these right now is the Cooper line. That is the only one that isn't shown in this or this because it got it passed the seven factor. Or I say passed, that's the wrong. It wasn't classified distribution, excuse me. So it was classified transmission. But then it failed all of these, so it wasn't a yes on this one either. So it is not in either one of these because it wasn't a yes for either one. The only one.
There were a number of unanimous ones that were out, transmission segments that were out in Golden Valley's region.
You're correct.
And they weren't distribution.
They were classified as distribution. It was quite interesting, actually. So what we did, just to clarify, is we did both of these at the same time, and it was quite interesting. We did Mansfield. I didn't exclude from the Mansfield the seven factor because we were doing them at the same time in the technical working group. But once we had solidified these were the seven factor, I actually pulled them out, and I was like, oh, they're all excluded under the seven factor. That's why they didn't pass any of the Mansfield. It kind of made sense to me that everything got pulled out except for Cooper, which wound up being a no for both. So it is not a line on here.
So this is the 100 and this lists the 126 of the 127
yes.
lines. Okay. I thought there were I didn't realize that the
Yeah, I
the
didn't either until I, yep.
at Golden Valley
wound up
fell out as distribution.
Yep. That's exactly what happened. So sure. It's quite interesting.
Just from a procedural standpoint, I guess I'm just curious to know, maybe from Carl's perspective, if we don't move forward with an affirmative or a yes or no on these 11 lines, does it put us back in terms of the development of the actual OAT or the ATRR in any way that would be detrimental?
Thank you for the question. The thing that it will affect is the financial analysis that we hopefully we can use in order to determine the rate formula for the RTO rate. So that's what it was. Now it could be that we could provide an option to say look at it with and without those. So we can do that also, either with the 11 or the actual one that's in there too, is to do a make the financial analysis, give you answers for both those cases too. So it's really up to you about how it does it, whether it passes or not. We can give the information. It's a matter of whether that'll be useful in determining the formula needed for the RTO rate.
And then just as another follow-on, I guess, from the CFO group perspective, I think we're working to set up ourselves up with a format that once we determine how many of these lines or how many miles of line or whether they're evaluated on miles and capacity and how that affects it, it kind of is applied to the ATRR. And so just from my perspective, I think being hung up on over like maybe 11 lines isn't as detrimental, because I do see that kind of format coming to this group maybe for review, and then we understand how we're going to be discounting that ATRR by any lines that ultimately get excluded. In my perspective, I don't know that driving to conclusion on any of these 11 lines necessarily holds up the ATRR development for now.
Arthur Miller, I think we need to move forward. I think that there, you know, it's mid-May. We need to have this done by the end of June. Everyone knows that they reserve their ability to conduct additional analysis. I think that's well understood. We've talked about that repeatedly. But at the same token, my vote is we move forward, and this can be revisited at an appropriate time in the future. But I don't think we want to hold back and create additional options or required analysis from the working group. I think the working group has got more than enough on their plates between now and the end of June. And I do not want to add more to their plate.
Yeah, I would concur. I think there's plenty, you know, if there are challenges to what the working group has done, we have the commission, and it becomes a case of facts in front of the commission. And that's how utilities do business. It's business. So,
comments? Okay, so the motion on the table is to accept the recommendations of the line segments that were contested, as listed in the presentation. And so, Jennifer, we could do a roll call vote.
Yes. Point of clarification. You're pointing to this list, or which list are we looking at?
So these are the 11 contested lines that were in the presentation, broke out. They're all of them except for one, it sounds like, are in the two spreadsheets as well, intermixed throughout.
Right. So the one that's out on the spreadsheet but is in on here, is that in the mix of voting yes or voting no?
So the recommendation would be no, because it didn't pass the test.
Okay. We got multiple lists here.
Absolutely.
It's out on both lists.
Okay.
That one line is out on
both
lists.
Okay. So understand.
So if we approve the recommendations that are on this list here, all would be accepted in other than CEA 0025, okay, which would not be accepted in based on the recommendation. Yeah, that's
just
the
Okay.
Thank you. Is that clear as mud to everybody? Sarah.
So we're voting, a yes vote would indicate that we are accepting all 11 lines.
We are accepting the recommendations. So it would accept all the ones that have yes for Mansfield, and the one that said no would not be included. Okay. So Jennifer, if we could do a roll call vote, please.
Okay. Matt Anisa, Electric Association.
Just to confirm, a yes is all of this, the recommendation, correct?
Correct.
Yes. MEA is a yes.
Golden Valley Electric Association?
Travis Million, yes.
Alaska Energy Authority?
Curtis Thayer, yes.
Chugach Electric Association?
Arthur Miller, yes.
City of Seward?
Brian Hickey, yes.
And Homer Electric Association?
Sarah Lamb, no.
The motion carries, Chair. Right.
Thank you, Jennifer. And thank you for the group for working through that process, as confusing as it was at times.
Robust.
Yes.
Just too many spreadsheets.
Yes. Okay, so just so everybody knows, we're at 11:07 right now. Our intention is to pause where we're at 11:30 and do a lunch break, and then we'll continue on through that. So for right now, we will go ahead and tee up item 8D, which is the presentation on HB 307, OAT requirements and proposed changes to the FERC pro forma OAT. So that will be handed over to Mr. Carl and Daniel Heckman. So we will move on to that item.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this will be kind of a tag team effort between Mr. Monroe and myself. I will be discussing probably the first handful of slides here, just to again set the stage for the discussion, and then Mr. Monroe will take.
We got Mr. Monroe here on the end. Just if you're tag teaming, sorry.
If you don't mind, I would sit on the end over there.
Okay, you're sharing a microphone. That's all. Okay. Yeah, that other one I just don't think is quite up to par. The one in the back.
For those that are online, we're just digging up the presentation and working on getting that up, so please stand by for a few minutes. Call for a 5-minute recess as we get this set up.
Right on time.
She sent it to me. I have it. I just didn't put it in my.
Okay.
I just didn't put it in my.
Sounds good.
Okay, yeah. You're back on the record.
Yeah, Brian jumped the gun, and I'm like, I don't know.
All right, thank you, Jennifer. Yeah. So, Mr. Heckman and Mr. Monroe, we will begin with your presentation. And again, just a reminder, about 11:30, we'll be taking a break for lunch.
I think this is Mr. Heckman with Golden Valley, Daniel Heckman with Golden Valley. I think this will take us right at a good spot for that break. So. Alrighty, so what we're doing here is again setting the stage for a discussion on the open access transmission tariff and proposed deletions and other changes to be considered. And again, we're going to start with House Bill 307 that created the Railroad Transmission Organization, and kind of consistent with the previous discussion and public presentation, again, 307 called for disk transmission organization. It was created for the purpose of establishing an open access transmission tariff. And there were specific provisions in the legislation that said what this tariff was supposed to do. One, it was to provide for recovery of transmission costs and related ancillary services. And then the second piece is to replace wholesale charges assessed by unit by each utility in the rail belt with a new mechanism that fairly recovers and equitably allocates those costs of operating the backbone transmission system. So, again, in the previous, in other parts of the legislation, again, we were charged with holding and administering this open access transmission tariff. And then we are charged with filing it, file it with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, consistent with Federal Energy Regulatory Commission standards to remove impediments to competition in the wholesale bulk power marketplace in the state. And to kind of allude to a couple of times the statutory timeline that we're all working under, for the public, if you look at, in AS 4483710, the language is in bolded, but essentially the statement is that this transmission organization is charged with filing this open access transmission tariff on or before July 1st of 2025. Otherwise, the Regulatory Commission, after notice and opportunity for public comment, shall establish one. So then, we've kind of was touching on this in the previous public presentation, but again, just to kind of just make it clear on the record, this tariff must pool backbone transmission costs and then allocate those costs through the certificated load-serving entities. Coincident peak or load ratio share basis or a combination of both. We have to also account for required backbone transmission system ancillary services, system congestion, any disruptions to the backbone transmission system that result in the isolation of one geographical area of that system from one or more from one another for more than 24 hours. And the cost to own and operate the backbone transmission system as established by the commission or by contract, including the transmission costs associated with the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project. So that was House Bill 307. Just to really kind of explain more about where the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission comes from on this, in April 24th of 1996, the Federal Commission issued Order 888, which basically serves as the foundation for the FERC approach on open access transmission tariffs. It essentially said that all utilities underneath its jurisdiction has to file an open access transmission tariff that contain minimum terms and conditions of non-discriminatory service, but then also permits those utilities and transmitting entities to recover a legitimate, prudent, and verifiable costs associated with providing open access and transmission tariff. And again, the key takeaway, the policy goal here is to remove impediments to competition in a wholesale bulk power marketplace and bring more efficient, lower-cost power to consumers. And that's verbatim language from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's resources on this. So tying this, the FERC process and the Alaska process together here, how do they work together? So in what's called pre-filed testimony, and this is just Regulatory Commission of Alaska jargon that we filed testimony in support of our certificate application. We basically stated that we would start with Order 888 as that is the baseline a standard and approach. And then we committed to describing major deletions, changes, or additions made by the RTO. And that is, the working group has done a series of page turns and reviews of various sections on the OATE for this purpose. The latest version of the FERC pro forma OATE is dated December 16th 2021. That was the starting place. And in order to, and to kind of get into a more thorough discussion on the proposed deletions and modifications and additions, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Corman Rowe, who has been an outside consultant to the working group, has been a resource for us, has significant experience doing some of this work down in the lower 48, especially through the Southwest Power Pool. So I will turn over to him to start the discussion on the deletions and modifications we have made to the ODE for proposal.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you for the opportunity to speak and to give you some of the experiences that I've gone through in this and trying to understand how FERC looks at open access and kind of the proposals that they had within the, as Daniel talked about, the 888. So I just first just stop and ask if there's any questions about the use of that FERC 888 open access tariff as being the standard. It seemed like to us from the language in HB 307 that that's what they were pointing to. So I don't know if anybody has questions about that. All right. Yes, John.
John Sinclair, MEA. That was just the basis, and now we're obviously taking stuff out, adding stuff in. That was just kind of the foundation that we started with, correct?
Yes, sir. For sure, Mr. Sinclair, you're right. And particularly, it's understood that it needs to fit the Alaska Rail Belt system, too. And so it's not just that it's we're looking at it from the perspective of what FERC required, but how it fits the existing, both the legislation and the existing functions and what is done in the rail belt, too, and that we have to take that into account as we go forward, too. And particularly, FERC has evolved that tariff from its roots, and its roots started more out where your roots started out. So we had to look at those things that they've even added in subsequent orders to change the 888 tariff to see if that fit with what was required both in HB 307 and in what Alaska would have.
Thank you.
Yeah. So as we've gone through this, of course, we've looked at the FERC 888 tariff and looked at these in the three categories that we talked about, possible deletions or proposed deletions, possible modifications to the tariff, and then things that we might have to add to the tariff, too, based on the particular aspects of both things that need to be added just for Alaska, but for the HB 307, too, to meet those requirements, too. So we're going to go through the proposed deletions. Looks like it's 11:25. I could start in this one. This one's going to take a little bit of time, so it might be good to take the break at this point and then pick it up afterwards to start on the deletions.
I think that is a great time to break on that. So we'll go ahead and take a break 30 minutes for lunch.
Yeah, lunch in the back.
Okay. So we'll take a break for 30 minutes for those that are on the phone, and then we will pick back up at, let's just go straight up 12 o'clock, make it easy on everybody. Okay.
We call it a point of receiving, point of delivery, where you receive the power and then deliver the power to. And then network service was really intended to be what the general use of the facilities were anyway, is to a set of generators to a set of load. And so that's what network service was. And when they originally put point-to-point in the tariff, their proposal or what their purpose was in order to deliver actually between oats so that you could export out of one oat and receive it into another oat itself. But the network was really meant to be the main portion of what service would be, because it's serving load, which is the main purpose of transmission, is to serve load itself. And they recognized that was, of course, in not stepping into the retail side of that too at the same time. So currently in the regional tariffs in lower 48, the point-to-point really is not used internally anymore. It's only used for especially these regional tariffs. And when I talk about regional tariffs, I'm talking about tariffs that involve more than one transmission owner that have, in essence, provided a tariff together to actually use their whole systems together, which sounds real similar to what HB 307 is asking you to do. So that's why I use the term regional tariff. I look at the rail belt as a regional tariff, and we'll get into more of that when we talk about the planning activities, too, just so that we know that that's and what FERC's done in that regard. But so in these regional tariffs, it's become apparent to the regional tariffs that they that point-to-point internal doesn't make any sense anymore. And so that seems to be an indicator that we don't really need point-to-point. Well, first of all, there's no other tariff that you would, if this tariff is accepted, there's no other tariffs that would be granting transmission service in and out of that system or through that system. and also, as it's stated in the last bullet, it's a real intensive thing to provide point-to-point service. Because the first thing you have to do is you have to do analysis on how much capacity is available at every future point in the going out, actually for out to years. You know, you start with hour by hour and then day by day, then week by week, month by month, and then out to hours. You got to calculate all that. And you have to post that. And then you have to take independent requests for each of the point-to-point service. You have to put that in in FERC's case, put that on what they called the OASIS of posting mechanism, where you published all that information and used it to grant service of point to point. And so it's real intensive too, and it just doesn't seem like it makes any sense in this regard, particularly because all the load will be served, by NITs, in this construct using the open access tariff. All the load would be served by NITs. Each of the load serving entities or the people that serve load have their generators to serve their load that they'd be referencing through that NIT service. They also have the ability to do economic transactions through what they call secondary service in the NITs itself too. So even that is covered in what types of service is available. So that's why the proposed deletion of the point-to-point, it deletes a significant portion of the tariff and administration of the tariff, too. So I can take any questions that anybody has on that. Yes,
Mr. Hicks. Question, and I'm just, I don't know if the committees or the working group has thought of come across this yet, but, you know, there are a number of open access transmission tariffs already on file. Chugach has one, Golden Valley has one, the Alaska Intertie has adopted an open access transmission tariff. How will those, will we just rescind all those, or will those just be withdrawn, or do those still exist in some form? Or has that been discussed? Now, if it, I don't mean to put you on the spot, if it hasn't, we should probably talk about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we've talked about, we talked in general, we'll say, about what has to be, what has to take place in order to implement this open access tariff. And one of those things would be revisions to the existing tariffs themselves. And it's almost anticipated since the HB 307 was requiring you to do this that you don't need to have those in your tariff anymore. And so those things that would, quote, grant transmission service in some way will probably not be needed in any of the tariffs.
So that there would be some process by which I guess the utilities and the IMC would have some formal action to rescind their tariffs and adopt this one as
yeah, it is a that's a larger question too beyond that, I'll put it that way. And we'll get into another portion of it in the ancillary services, but there's another portion of it that says how do you actually take this tariff and implement it, this new tariff and implement it? Because it does, as you would probably realize, it does change the way you would recover your ATRR costs because it tells you to do that in HB 307 to recover it through this tariff. So from that particular perspective, it's a large effort to look through that. And so filing the tariff now starts setting up that process that then would have to go through on how do you make the changes to those tariffs.
Those
other tariffs to implement this tariff. And that's one of the things we'll have to do to implement the tariff, beyond some other things, too.
Joel? Yeah, thanks, Chair. I guess, so this is Joel Gross at the RC. I guess, thinking strategically on that 7-1 deadline, what would we need to do, to Brian's point, with, you know, the legacy OATS and the various load-serving entity tariffs, and, like, what extent do we need to like define a framework or a roadmap for 7-1 to kind of set that those future actions? I mean, that's all going to happen after 7-1, probably after the RCA approves the RTO's OAT. But you know, maybe we need to define like what that sequence is going to look like.
Yeah, and that's in discussions. The legal and regulatory group is actually taking those and is going through those discussions to try to determine that and all the aspects of the tariffs that have to be all the aspects of those tariffs that have to be considered. But as you know, there's also discussions on moving as we move forward and RRC changes. How do we coordinate those activities too with this tariff?
Yeah.
And actually their tariffs, too.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, thanks.
Arthur, do you have something?
Yes, thanks. Carl, can you talk a little bit, and if I'm premature in asking the question, if you're going to get to it later on, just say so. I'm happy to wait. But talk about the ancillary services aspect, scheduling, you know, voltage support, all of those elements, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, we will get to that if you don't mind, and we'll hold that when we talk about that. Let's talk about the general the general way in which we're going to handle the HB 307 requirement to handle that, to account for ancillary services in general, and then we can talk about specific ones if we need to how each of those might be done.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Other questions or concerns? All right, let's go to the next one then. In the original 888 tariff, and again, I'll tell you how it has evolved since that time, FERC in issuing the 888 tariff could only, of course, require those parties that were jurisdictional to it to actually file open access tariffs. So that, for the most part, was investor-owned utilities, as you probably realize. Those were the ones that were under the jurisdiction of FERC. At the same time, they actually did also require to put a reciprocal language in the tariff, which, again, we've deleted that. It's a small piece, but that other parties who had transmission that wanted to use the OATT transmission had to have an OATT too. So, anyway, that just tried to force everybody. But when they originally did it, they understood that they couldn't force the utility who owned the transmission to take service under that tariff. They could own what they could have done because of the retail load that would be taking their load, which they called native load, and had to take service under that tariff. But they did require under 888 that their service, the transmission owner's service, which they call native load, would have to follow all the non-rate terms and conditions of the OAT2. So in essence, they wanted to ensure that as the OATs needed to be open access and non-discriminatory, as even quoted in the HB 307, that everybody's load would be treated the same, or everybody using the transmission system would be treated the same, but not require them to do service. Now, the interesting thing also is, even though they quoted that it was non-rate terms and conditions, that they would also be monitoring the rates to make sure that the parties who were using the system were paying comparable rates themselves, too, and that they were non-discriminatory. So in all the regional tariffs, there was also a restriction that was put in because they believed that as you went to a regional tariff, you could not grant to native load the use of other facilities outside that transmission owner's facilities. So that if you were just continued to take native load, then you would have to use something else in order to do a use of everybody else's facilities itself. and so that really, in that case, and it made sense because you were only, quote, native load. You were only signing up for that service that your transmission owner. You only had service for your transmission. That if you wanted to do outside of that, you needed to take NIT service. So, and some of the regional tariffs actually, in the regional tariff, all the parties agreed to get rid of native load service and just take NIT service itself. So what's evolved with these regional tariffs is everybody takes native load service. And the reason being is that you're paying through native load service for the use of all the facilities within the region or within that regional tariff. So it means that you don't have to buy additional service to use those other facilities, point-to-point service or anything else. You could use it as network service. And in particularly, it also added the concept of this secondary service. So when you ask for network service, you say, here's my load, here's my generators, and that's the transmission service that I get firm, in essence. I get that, you know, that's firm service, and everybody gets firm service based on that. If you want to do economy energy sales and use the transmission as available, then you would use what they call secondary service. So there's the capability within using NIT service and not having native load service anymore, where all the parties in this tariff would have the capability both to do what they do today in serving their own load from their own generators, but also to be able to exchange energy on an economy basis as the transmission's available too. So that helps to meet the HB 307 requirements, where all the load has access to the full transmission system, because all the loads would be under NITS and not any under native load. Any questions or comments about that?
I don't know if you misspoke or if it sounded like you were saying that all the regional oats have gone to native load service.
No, to NIT service.
Okay, you had said native load service. Okay,
I was
thinking about that before I go.
No, okay, I misspoke. If I said that,
okay,
I misspoke. Because
yeah,
they've all gone.
Yeah.
In fact, all of the ones that are the big regional ones like PJM, ISO, and SPP, they all have no more parties taking native load service.
We're good.
All right. Next one. The big discussion that we had to do with the requirements within the 888 tariff for planning activities, which included any studies, transmission analysis, or any other planning requirements. And so the discussion actually was very helpful to have the RRC as part of the organization in trying to understand what both their requirements are and what their future aspects of the way in which they were looking at meeting their requirements, and particularly with the IRP and other transmission standards and stuff like that was mostly what we were focused on this for. And so in some regards, that provides some of the mechanisms that FERC expected the RTO to have, because they wanted someone to have a non-discriminatory planning process or study process or analysis process. So within that, they had that as a function of the RTO. And in this case, HB 307 didn't require it, of course, in the first place, and the requirements on the RRC seemed to indicate that we had to coordinate with their activities and that they were soon to do that. So at least currently what we're proposing in the tariff is that before we have that ability to coordinate with the RRC and their responsibilities, that we use the planning processes as they're used today, just monitored by the RTO. In other words, not doing those processes through the RTO, but monitoring it, particularly having the RTO informed whenever there were these analyses were going to start and what reasons they were, in essence, starting those processes. And then part of the back end of that process is going through what we talked about earlier this morning with the technical subcommittee, was how do we determine the BTS and non-BTS facilities themselves. And so that would be a checkpoint for the RTO to see what planning processes were and what facilities were being planned itself. And that would be a check also for anybody that wanted service outside of the parties that were doing the service to check to make sure that those were being done non-discriminatorily. So what we've done in the tariff is we've put that language in the tariff to specify that was what would be done, but deleted all the things that required the RTO to do the planning requirements. And that would include the big one is attachment K, which is all the planning aspects, and that includes the requirements that FERC just issued in the 1920 requirements, too, that none of those would be on the RTO themselves. Now, I said I'd mention something in here, and it's not exactly on the slide, so I'm just going to tell you what I talked about regional tariffs, and FERC has been was first of all concerned that the regional tariffs ensure that the regional tariffs were doing a non-discriminatory and doing an effective planning process, and so all of the all the regional tariffs had those responsibilities, and so FERC was pushing for them to look at cost allocation methodologies for new facilities itself, and so we'll deal with that in a few with this tariff too. We're still just starting those discussions. But at the same time, they had to deal with interregional, which meant between tariffs, too. So 1920 really focused on interregional aspects of planning. In this case, with this tariff, it's going to be a region, which means we need to ensure that we're non-discriminatory in doing those things in a way. And, again, we think that the things that we're proposing to change will help us do that for the RTO. But there really is no interregional aspects that need to be considered here, so none of that will be in the tariff itself, too. So that's the reason I brought that up. Any questions about planning activities? We are working through a process and trying to define that process more, and I'll just tell you a more general concept is a lot of times we found and a lot of parties found that as we implemented the tariffs, the language told us, you know, exactly what we needed to do, but to put the details together, we do business practices. So some of these things will be further defined in business practices, so we know, just like the technical subcommittee's aspects of determining what's BTS and non-BTS. All right. Then the next one is operational requirements and based on the HB 307, not really putting any kind of, all the HB 307 said was administer the tariff, not administer the operations in the tariff, that those requirements that were in FERC OATT and that were that to meet the reliability standards that are needed, those responsibilities are currently with the TOs and expected to stay with both the TOs and the balancing authorities. And other things that FERC defined, actually, that FERC agreed to through NERC standards themselves. So this is another point where with the RRC, as they go through those standards, we'll have to monitor those to see how we need to either affect the tariff that we have or if there's effects on the utilities tariffs for those itself. FERC assumed that those NERC activities were provided by the tariff operator. And in fact, the tariff operator set up operation centers and real-time monitoring systems, real-time calculations of things. They put operators in place that had authority over the operations of those. And there's nothing like that that we can see is required to meet the HB 307 intent of the tariff. And so we have removed a lot of that activity. There will be statements in there that say the TO has to, with the network customer, the NITS customer, have to coordinate those activities, but there'll be nothing that the RTO itself will do. Any questions or comments about that?
I think we're good.
All right, one more. I think this is the last one, I think. Let me look. Yeah, this is the last one for deletions. So there are regulatory filings that were stated to be required within the tariff. And so at the current time, we're not sure how – we know that some of those are not going to be required because some of the sections that were required, we've already pulled out those sections to require the RTO's responsibility in those, so there wouldn't be filings that they don't have a responsibility for. But there are other, there are some that we'll have to, we have to decide how to handle those. And those will be under the modifications more than they would be deletions, because there are sections in there we have to do that. For instance, when you change a service agreement, you know, do you have to file a service agreement in the first place? Do you have to change, do you have to do it if it's non-standard is the only reason you'd have to do a service agreement or things like that? Or when you change the rates, how do we do that through the process? And so we're still under discussions about how that will, and again, it's key to lining that up with the changes that you'll have to make within your tariffs, if there's changes you have to make within your tariffs based on changes within the RTO tariff or just particularly for rates itself and how that's billed and recovered. So we know that there's some of those that may require regulatory filings, but we're working on those, but we have deleted some out just based on not having those responsibilities of the RTO. And then there was a whole set of OATT attachments, and I'll tell you, there are a significant number of those OATT attachments that we've deleted. FERC has assigned responsibilities to the RTOs or to the regional tariffs way beyond what the HB 307 is talking about. For instance, having imbalanced markets and having real-time markets and things like that that were attachments on the current 888 that Daniel referenced that we don't have, the RTO won't have any of those responsibilities, so they're being deleted out too. So those are all the proposed large deletions. There's language changes all over that you could look at this way, but we looked at most of those, the big ones as modifications that we'll at least introduce after we've done the, after we've gone through this, and explain the deletions. And then if you want to do the voting now, that would be appropriate, or we can wait until we go through some of the modifications too.
Joel?
Yeah, this is a super high level question. As you're formatting the RTO's OAT, are you, and you're modifying it to these necessary Alaska adaptations, are you preserving the FERC outline, like, you know, this section reserved for future use type of thing, and keeping the numbering and whatnot aligned, or are you just rolling this thing up to an Alaska-specific outline?
Yeah, we did not do that. We will explain in the filing what we've talked about already in the deletions and the modifications and additions. We'll talk about those and reference those, and we'll be referencing the FERC 88 sections when we talk about those, too. But we haven't done that. When we delete some of these larger sections out and don't expect to recover those, we didn't see any need to actually keep the numbering the same.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question of, like, trying to future-proof something where the future is so murky that it's just like,
yeah.
Just asking questions.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, in some instances, even within FERC, when FERC would require something new, all the regional tariffs might have already done some of that and had those in different forms in their tariffs, and they had to align. Actually, what they've had to do is prove that their section and what they were doing was superior to what FERC was now proposing as an open access tariff. So anyway. So even within the regional tariffs, there's a lot of differences in the way even FERC, between the FERC 88 tariff and what they have approved by FERC now.
Any other questions for Carl on the deletion so far? So there is a proposal or a recommendation from Council that we could go ahead and vote on the deletions, because then that gives the direction for the working group to continue to develop the OAT and not have to spend any more time on the deleted items for the reasons that Carl mentioned. And then what we'll do is go through the proposed modifications, and then we would actually see those once the document's developed and more fleshed out at that point for our review and final approval at that point. So what I'd recommend is if the group is good for it, to make a proposal or a motion to approve the deleted items as Carl has presented here today for us, so we can get that off the plate of the group.
Let me take an attempt. I move to approve the proposed section deletions from FERC 88 tariff presented today to be excluded from the Railroad Transmission Organization tariff.
Is there a second?
Second.
Vicki. Any discussion on this topic? Okay. Jennifer, if we could do a roll call vote for the motion that's on the table.
Yes, sir. So, Golden Valley Electric Association?
Travis Million, yes.
Alaska Energy Authority?
Curtis Thayer, yes.
Chugach Electric Association?
Arthur Miller, yes.
The City of Seward?
Brian Hickey, yes.
Homer Electric Association?
Sarah Lamb, yes.
Matanuska Electric Association?
John Sinclair, yes.
The motion carries, Chair.
Okay. Thank you. All right, Mr. Monroe, back to you to walk through the proposed modifications, and I'd say that we're probably not going to spend a ton of time into them because we're going to spend a lot more time as they get to it, but if you want to just hit the high level to let us know what's forthcoming.
I'll do that. And since you all have the presentation, I'm not going to read some of this to you. I'll just give you the overall perspective. The first one has to do with the customer definition, and it really has to be changed in order to reflect Alaska, and particularly not to follow the federal rules on some of these things, but to follow state rules on those. So that's generally what's been changed in those and trying to understand. And again, I'll tell you just a general concept. The eligible customers are people who could apply for NIT service, in essence, in the tariff. But if you have service, you're called a network customer, just to make that distinction. So this is just people that are eligible to apply for service. The second one is ancillary services. So this is to get to Mr. Arthur's question. So at least and that's the next slide, yeah. So Mr. Heckman talked about, it does, the HB 307 does say that we have to account for ancillary services and the cost of ancillary services themselves. Now, I'll tell you, in when a lot of these regional tariffs were put together, the first incarnation of those regional tariffs, there were still multiple balancing authorities within each of those areas. And those, as even if you read through the original 888 order, you could see that FERC was pointing to those responsibilities as being balancing authority responsibilities, a lot of these particular ancillary services itself. And so from that particular perspective, since we're not talking about consolidating balancing authorities here, we can take that kind of premise that was used in the FERC tariff, where these regional tariffs would point back to the provision of those services through the ancillary services. They did require that the parties would be, that third parties would be able to either self-provide or obtain from other third parties those ancillary services, some of the ancillary services, but that the balancing authorities would have to validate that those were actually provided itself. There's some of the RTOs, regional RTOs, that are regional tariffs where they would say, in the tariff, they would say, you can go buy them from the balancing, in essence, buy them from the balancing authority, self-provide, or obtain them otherwise, as long as they were validated by the balancing authority. You can require the OAT to provide those services, but all the OAT was going to do is go to the balancing authority and ask them, you know, to provide the service. So in essence, it was better that you went to the balancing authority. We just took that other step out and just said, just go to the balancing authority and provide those. There's two of them, the scheduling and system control and dispatch service and the reactive service that have to be provided by the balancing authority itself. They could arrange with the balancing authority to say they didn't have to have the service, but they'd have to validate that, at least the reactive supply. But the scheduling, they had to pay that one. Everybody had to pay that from the balancing authority itself. All the other ones, regulation, all the operating reserve ones, imbalance ones, they could self-provide or obtain otherwise, as long as the balancing authority agreed to that. This is one area where the tariffs themselves, as you have them today, define your tariffs, define those ancillary services for the balancing authorities. And that's what FERC allowed, at least in those early incarnations of the tariff, to refer to those schedules. And as long as they were filed, then they could use those service schedules. And so that's one place where probably your tariffs will still be necessary to deal with those services themselves. Does that help with your questions, or do you have any other questions?
Uh,
No, that's helpful. Thank you. Actually, Carl, I'm sorry. If I could ask one question on
that.
Oh,
yes. So
on the scheduling system control and dispatch service, can you go into more detail? How would that be done? So each utility would be responsible for their own scheduling and dispatch services. If even in a situation, let's just hypothetically say power is transferred from Homer to Golden Valley, they wouldn't pay any scheduling service, even though it's going through several areas.
This is one area where we're proposing a modification that we need to tie down is when you're crossing balancing authority boundaries, do you have to pay both or do you just pay one of them? You have to at least pay one of them, but it's whether you pay two of them or not. And so we're trying to tie that down. In a lot of the regional tariffs, they just decided since load was the one paying for transmission service, then the receiving balancing authority schedule was paid and not the providing balancing authority. So that was the normal course of things. And so we're still having that discussion about for all of the ancillary services in the first place, besides the scheduling one. So it may be just one or it could be two depending on. Now, the interesting thing is nobody ever included the intervening balancing authorities because for the most part, those were just schedules that went through them. So there was no ancillary services that needed to be provided just for that going through them. So
that's still under discussion.
But it's still under discussion, yeah.
The leaning is toward the receiving utility.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
That makes sense from my perspective for sure. Thank you.
Curtis? Yeah, just a question. What's the timing for kind of that recommendation to come before the governance committee to vote?
I suspect it's in your next meeting that we'll be bringing
it. Yeah, I just want to make sure timeline-wise.
Yeah. Introducing it now so that you understand that there will be some of these that we'll be bringing to you again. All right. Backup one. Responsible designee in the OAT. So we had to call whoever was doing it. We could call it the RTO, but the concern with that at least some parties expressed is using RTO in the, first of all, FERC uses transmission provider in the tariff to say who actually administers the tariff, who's doing all the functions. So of course in the tariff it says, you know, the customer is responsible for this, and this one it'll say the TO is responsible, the balancing authority is responsible, but you had to have who's the administrator. And so they used the TP or transmission provider. It was used in that. Now, HB 307, as we've already talked about, didn't assume all the same duties that FERC assumed that the transmission provider would be doing. And so we don't want it confused so that parties were to read this tariff and expect that if they read transmission provider, those functions were being provided by the RTO. There is the modification suggestion that we're pretty firm on is to change it to transmission service administrator, so it's just the administrator of the transmission service instead of the TP. All right, next one. Posting requirements. I talked about the OASIS already, based on looking at the requirements itself and trying to understand what requirements it might be for public posting of information, we don't believe that the OASIS itself will be required and all the details that FERC actually even had another order, 889, that went through all the things that had to be posted. And most of it, the vast majority of it, was for point-to-point service. That's another administrative burden that we don't believe that is necessary because the function of it we don't need. And so there are areas that things need to be posted to make transparent. For instance, the current effective tariff needs to be posted somewhere. You know, so we're not going to have public postings of something. So we just replaced that section that said you have to do the OASIS and the 889 requirements that we will be doing public postings and list those things that need to be posted. Mr. Hickey.
Just a question. Do you envision any real-time data posting, or is it all documents and things of that nature?
Yeah, I don't think there will be any real-time postings that will be required on there, just based on the NIT service itself and the way that those postings are even done at the federal or at what FERC required even regional ones to do.
Okay.
There may be some historical data that needs to be posted. There may be some planning data. I don't know that is just the thing. I know there is when I suspect that what we'll have to do is when somebody makes a request for a change to their service agreement, we'll post that, have to post that.
Mm-hmm.
When the TO gets done with the planning process, you know, there maybe have to be a posting of the studies or something along that line. So those are the kinds of things that we're debating of what really needs to be posted.
Yeah, I was thinking in terms of like ICCP data, but we're not talking about that kind of stuff.
No, I don't think there's any. There was no requirement from FERC in the 888 for network service to do any of that.
Okay.
In fact, there was no requirement to post that in the first place. The only thing real time that that you had to post was how much capacity was available on the transmission system, who had made requests and stuff like that.
Okay.
So there was really no real time data
that
was posted anywhere. That was for cyber or for security purposes. Yes. Same time information system. Yeah. Good question. All right. So, yeah, FERC recognized that there were entities that might want to have a tariff. And particularly in regional tariffs, there were parties that might want to put their facilities in the tariff, but were not for jurisdictional. So we looked at that in the sense of what was the tariff requiring to be put into the tariff, but that the tariff should not change the regulatory environment of the entities. And that includes Seward, which Seward's talked about already, language to protect their tax-exempt bond requirements. But there's also, we're also considering modifications in some of the AEA requirements that they have, and even maybe some for the co-ops themselves. So there may be provisions within the tariff that says, by doing this, we're not changing this regulatory environment that's in place, that's not changed by the HB 307. So trying to follow all the rules and laws in the current that weren't changed by HB 307. And then there are charges that were put in there, and particularly most of the charges besides the transmission service was ASA services, which we've already talked about. And then for studies, when somebody requested a change in their service agreement or a planning study or something along those lines to pay for those, which we've already talked about, that the RTO won't be responsible for those. But there may be an additional charge based on this one task that the RTO may have to determine between BTS and non-BTS facilities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only thing. And that's just we're in the scratching our heads about whether that needs to be done or not. All right. So then the largest section in the tariff, part one of the tariff is, for the most part, it's just definitions. Part two of the tariff in the original 888 was point-to-point. So if we take that out, then part two becomes NITS, which is part three in the FERC tariff, in the FERC 888 tariff. And so generally, all the changes within there, we've already talked about deletions that would affect all of that, which the first deletion was point-to-point, but deletions having to do with planning and operations. There's a lot of specificity in the tariff about some of that stuff that's no longer would no longer be the RTO responsibility. So those are either taken into account in what we've already talked about in deletions and modifications. And then we talked about this requesting of modifications need to go to the TO who's affected first and the RTO informed about that, and then the TO would provide back to the RTO studies, analysis, or requirements that would need to be included when we look at both the BTS versus non-BTS assessment, but also what needed to be changed in the service agreement for the customer. For instance, if somebody comes in and says, I've got a new generator and I want to deliver it to my load. It's not an existing generator. I got a new generator to deliver to my load, and you have to do transmission upgrades to do that. You know, we'll have to determine what's BTS and not BTS and how that affects the rate of the RTO. But beyond that, in the service agreement, it will have to list those facilities, because in essence, you can't grant that service until those facilities are built. So that's one, just a particular instance of that. All right. HB 307 did actually require the OAT to deal with a backbone transmission system congestion. And so the suggested modifications is actually just to list that the existing processes for dealing with congestion or system conditions, since the RTO doesn't have any operating responsibilities, that those would continue to be done by the existing balancing authorities or transmission operators. And so that's really what the intent of trying to do. So we're going to deal with congestion, and it'll list the things in the – it'll list in the tariff the kinds of things that congestion covers, which goes beyond – I'll tell you what the 888 – not 888, but what the lower 48 is calling congestion is mostly – redispatch opportunities that need to be because of transmission limitations. But there's other things like that you have to have the ability to do to maintain the security and reliability of the transmission system, which y'all all know is there's a lot of other operational aspects. So it'll cover all of those under the congestion relief and assigning those to who does those today, which is the balancing authorities and TOs. And then also the other thing that Mr. Hegman pointed out was disruptions that isolate an area for more than 24 hours. And so the consideration there, it seemed like that the indication was, since we had to account for it, the accounting, we couldn't account for it since we didn't have any operational or planning responsibilities. That really should be done in the planning and the operational environment. But it had to do with the tariff and the cost. And so we just started talking about that, and there's one proposal on the table that's been submitted was to say if somebody's more than 24 hours off, then they only pay their rate, you know, during that period. And that there's a lot of complications to that, just put it that way. Accounting-wise, there's a lot of complications to that. So we're just starting that discussion. But there will have to be a modification based on HB 307. All right, now some additions. So one thing that FERC in their orders always give the purpose of those, gives the purpose of the tariffs, the RTO working group feels like there needs to be an introduction that gives the purpose of the tariff so that when a person picks up the tariff, they can read through and understand what the tariff really was meant for. And so we've got a party that's drafting that for us. To see what we do. And then, of course, the RTO rates themselves is how do you calculate the rates? And that's, of course, as you know, is going to be a big discussion about doing that. We know that at least the HB 307 says you get the transmission cost, which we're terming it somewhat similar to what everybody knows they do for even Form 1 is and some have done within your own tariffs of calculating an annual transmission revenue requirement. And so we're using those terminologies. And as Sarah talked about, there's work going on in that area. And particularly, it looks like what we're going to have to do is ensure that we know what ATRRs come from each TO. There's a basic premise that we're working from is that those would need that calculations and or that ATR itself would have to be approved by the commission as they do today. before it gets to the RTO. But then the RTO would, first of all, either the RTO or the transmission owner would have to differentiate the ATRR that's only for the BTS, for the backbone transmission system, and then that's what would be accumulated, and then the calculation hopefully would be more formulaic, taking the calculation from that and calculating the rate that each NITS customer would pay. And that would include, you know, at least accumulating the ATRR some way and calculating the distribution or the allocation of that based on what HB 307 said, which is either using some coincident peak issue or load issue, load amount issue. So we know that that's what has to be done. And so that's why we've, you know, the work that's being done on the ATRR to make sure that we have some consistency in the ATRR so that when we accumulate it together, it makes sense. But then also how we do that distribution. And so that'll have to be some proposal that comes forth to you about how we do those rate calculations themselves. Now, what really happens after that, actually not just setting the rates, because you're going to charge all the network customers, and so the RTO is going to collect all these charges from the network customers. What does it do with that revenue? It really, the intent was to redistribute it back out to the TOs to meet their ATRR requirements. So we know that has to be done. So in essence, in my mind, I usually thought of it as you had network customers that were buying service. They pay you, and you'd redistribute it back to the transmission owners to cover their ATRR. And so that's really the mechanisms that we're talking through itself. We're talking about if there's any requirements that may be needed for a transition period. In other words, are we setting something up right now that we know needs to be either reviewed or changed in the future? So we have a section in there that we can put that in. And as I just talked about a few minutes ago, we are talking about new transmission upgrades and modifications, any changes that are made. We know at least they have to be analyzed for the BTS, non-BTS. Any changes to the system, you need to go through that analysis. But then how do you incorporate them in rates? And there's different ways that they're done in the regional tariffs in the lower 48. So we're just going to have to decide for July 1st, what do we do? And then I think that that'll be one of those with the transition period. We need to look further into that detail in the future. Particularly, I'll tell you one, is we know that it probably makes sense to look at it again when we work through coordinating the activities of the IRP, that there may be some aspects of that that will help us with what do we do with the new transmission upgrades themselves, even the ones that are BTS. All right. So that's it. Those are all the modifications in addition, not all of them, but that's the major modifications in addition that we've been working through. We actually, with all the work that has been done, and it's been a fantastic group to work with and all the considerations of people, I just enjoy the give and take in there and also just the good discussion that we can have about different aspects of what we need to do. We've actually, I think, are getting close to language is in some sections. Some sections, as I talked about, we just started on one. So anyway. So any questions about where we are with the tariff or these additions, modifications?
No, I have no questions. I just want to thank you very much for the presentation. I think it's very important to get this on the public record so the public understands the direction we're going and what is going into this. It's very highly complicated, and I greatly appreciate the team's efforts and you being able to sustain it today, you and Daniel. Appreciate
thank
it.
You. Thank you.
All the team, all the tower group.
Any other questions for Carl on this subject? Thank you very much, Carl. Lots of work gone into it so far. Still a lot of work to get us to the finish line, but we're making good progress.
Thank you.
The next item we're going to be moving into is a presentation on the revenue mechanism that Mr. Heckman is going to head up. But I think for Brian's case, because we're going to be closing in 7 minutes to the threshold that he has set on me, we'll go ahead and take a 5-minute break or 8-minute break, 7-minute break, and start back up at 1:00. So we'll take a quick break.
One's broken out.
Okay, Chair, you're back on the record.
All right, thank you, Jennifer. All right, moving on to item 8E of our agenda, a presentation on the revenue mechanism. Mr. Heckman, I believe you're going to kick that off for us today.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this is Daniel Heckman, McGowan Valley. I'll wait until the presentation is up. Okay, thanks, Jeffrey. Alrighty, so this is just a very brief overview of the revenue mechanism component of this effort. We are, as Ms. Monroe alluded to earlier, we've you know touched this off. It's been discussed at the working group, and the CFOs of the various utilities, AEA. And Seward have been working together on a cost allocation methodology that's related to this. So we're just going to touch on this from a very high level just to bring, again, public awareness to what we have been working on. And then we will get into a little bit more detail in successive agenda items today. So, again, just to see where we were at, HB 307, as part of that statutory construct, asked or required that the RTO create an open access transmission tariff that, one, again, provides for recovery of transmission costs and related ancillary services, and then, two, replaces wholesale charges assessed by each unit by each utility with the new mechanism that fairly recovers and equitably allocates those costs of operating the backbone transmission system. In other areas of 307, 710, again, we've kind of gone through a lot of this already today, but again, the tariff must pool those transmission system costs, allocate those costs through certified load-serving entities, on a coincident peak or load ratio share basis or a combination of both, accounting for various aspects unique to the railroad electric system, account for ancillary services, congestion, disruptions to the backbone transmission system for more than 24 hours, and cost to own and operate the backbone transmission system as established by the commission or by contract. And the railroad utility is required to pass the commission-approved transmission costs directly and transparently to the utility's customers. And this, again, kind of breaks out what we just talked about just in a little bit more kind of more just apparent. Again, the revenue mechanism has to replace wholesale charges assessed by the unit by each utility, and this goes to the concept of addressing pancaked wheeling across the railroad electric system. Again, has to pull the backbone transmission system costs, fairly recover and equitably allocate those costs, and then allocate BTS costs through the certificated load serving entities. And again, I guess for purposes of that definition, the load serving entities we're talking about here are essentially the railroad electric utilities. On a coincident peak or load share ratio basis or a combination of both, and then account for these four main components that were listed in 307 that are unique to the railroad electric system. So then, as we go through this analysis, we're not only looking at the statutes that directly apply to the RTO that were created through 307, but then standard rate-making practices and statutes that are well-known to at least a regulated utility world. While we do have statutes that establish the parameters for the revenue mechanism, provides for a non-discriminatory open access tariff, et cetera. An RCA standard, and again, just for everyone's just to make it clear on the record, this is an organization that is subject to the authority of the RCA, and under their standard, rates have to be just and reasonable. That's pretty standard regulatory language. We're familiar with that. That is something that we are working through as we address some of these various aspects. So for a various a portion of the HB 307 statutes, AS 44-83-710 said that, again, we have to account for the cost to own and operate the BTS as established by the commission or by contract. And in pre-filed testimony that the RTO submitted in a previous commission docket, it states that the RTO will take transmission costs in each rail belt utility, specifically through express annual transmission revenue requirements, or ATRRs, and accumulate those onto an RTO ATRR. So we are, as I alluded to earlier, we are working on creating this ATRR for the BTS to comply with the statute. Again, recognizing the rate-making principle that's also in statutes and Alaska regulations that the cost causer and or the beneficiary of the BTS should be also be the cost payer. And then under a separate regulation, AEA, or the Alaska Energy Authority, collects rates in accordance with established contracts. And to account for the BTS ancillary services, as we, Mr. Monroe alluded to earlier in his presentation on the OAT, the railroad utilities currently have existing approved tariff rates for ancillary services. For those of the utilities that do have their own respective, basically their own open access transmission tariffs or a similar version of it in their existing tariffs, those ancillary services have already been approved, and that's how we're accounting for those in the BTS ancillary services. So for committee considerations, just some questions, you know, how should rates established by existing agreements be accounted for in the OAT? How should BTS costs be allocated? Should we do, are they going to be on a coincident peak, a load ratio share, or a combination of both? How should limited facilities and benefits provided be handled in the revenue mechanism? And I guess I want to make it very clear, when we talk about limited facilities here, the word limited is meant to talk about the limited ability for us currently to have power flow from one point on the system to the other. I guess we weren't trying to say anything on limited facilities as in like a small subset of facilities, because as this committee just did, the evaluation by the working group and this committee was on a broader set of facilities. So limited was a bad word choice there. So I want to make it clear on the record that by limited facilities, we're not talking about a subset group of facilities. We're talking about the flow of power from the one end of the system to the other that's currently limited, just as it currently stands today. So wanted to make that clarification on the record. Another, the last three, how would a revenue mechanism address disruptions in congestion? And how would a revenue mechanism address the RCA requirements that rates have to be non-discriminatory, just, and reasonable? And then, of course, how often will the RTO rates need to be updated? So that is just a pretty high level a discussion on the revenue mechanism, but there is more to discuss from both Mr. Monroe and Ms. Lamb as myself. So at this point, I will pause for questions.
Any questions for Daniel? Arthur?
Yes, let me go and start from the bottom up. First of all, when you say how often will RTO rates need to be updated, right, there is no RTO rates. Are you talking about, is this what you're really saying here is how often does each rail belt utility need to update the transmission revenue requirement that would go to the RTO for allocation of the costs? because, right, the RTO does not have rates. Maybe you could just clarify that, if that's how you're...
Yeah,
the
no.
intent of that language.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. So yeah, I would say, to answer your point, yes. How often would the rates be updated would be based on each utility updating their various ATRRs, but then if it touches the, if those are ATRRs that are touching BTS assets, that would still have to be, you know, flow through the revenue mechanism or the cost allocation mechanism that the RTO sets up. And to get maybe a little bit more detailed, we understand at the utility level for those that have ATRRs already, that in order to avoid any double recovery through the rates, that we at an individual level will have to ensure that there is, I would call it a scrub of our transmission revenue requirements to show that, okay, well, these are BTS assets. Those are now being addressed by the RTO through this revenue mechanism and cost recovery allocation, or it's non-BTS and that maintained, that's retained with the individual utilities.
One other point is on the back end of the RTO, both charging and giving back to the TOs the revenue requirement. if there's a difference between those two in the utility, you'd want some recovery mechanism. And so that back end recovery mechanism, we have to watch the timing of what you can, you know, what the front end, what when you get a change in an ATRR from a utility, how does that affect all the, in essence, all the utilities when they get to this back end net between what the customer pays and what the transmission owner gets as revenue requirement. So it's going to be, because it's going to change everybody's.
Right, exactly. So in that regard, you know, some utilities have just had a general rate case. There's, you know, the transmission revenue requirement is pretty fresh. Other utilities, it's been operating under the simplified rate filing process for a long time. So what's the thinking of the working group as far as how do we make sure that each utility is treated equitably in the context of the transmission revenue requirement update or calculation or frequency of that calculation, maybe the initial filing itself? Do we wait and implement the transmission rates after each utility submits their transmission revenue requirement and gets regulatory approval? The other question I have, so that's one question. The other question I have related to that, have you guys looked at establishing a consistent parameter or benchmark for how costs are to be allocated? So for sure, I'm sure not everybody allocates long-term interest expense the same way, or IDC, or AFUDC, or administrative in general. So is there, how are you guys thinking about that? And then also, knowing that we are one integrated transmission system, what is the working group's comments or feedback regarding the different tier levels among the utilities?
All right, so I will address the second, and I think maybe that was part of a third question there. So the CFO effort that is underway is intended to address the allocation of costs amongst the various entities, because to your point, yes, not all entities do this the same. So in order to have a more consistent approach, the CFO group, and I'll, and Ms. Lamb can speak to this in a little bit more detail, I'll speak it from a very high level, but essentially they have, through their efforts and through their consultants, have put together putting together a template based on all the FERC accounts that touch on transmission that really would constitute an ATRR, getting feedback from the various utilities on how they account for those various aspects, like administrative in general, kind of like to use that example. And then the takeaway from that is going to be a template that will say, okay, well then, this is how it will be shown on an apples-to-apples comparison, that each entity will then be responsible for basically putting in their values to show that there is that consistent approach. So that is, I will say, that is still in development. That is not ready for, that actually has not even come to the working group yet, but that is the pathway that we are embarking on to address the second question, the second part of your question. As far as TIER goes, I don't think we at this stage are thinking of attaching TIER to this, given the differences that we have amongst the entities on TIER. So I think at this stage, even trying to contemplate what that may look like, I think just from my perspective, sitting here is premature from at least where we're at in this point in the process. I think maybe flowing back to your first question as far as, you know, timing of all of this and everything, and how does this all get done? I think just from a broad perspective, the ODE will get filed, and yeah, whether it's, and this is something that the working group has still not come to an overall recommendation on, is that what will each individual entity do? I mean, if you're going to be filing a rate case, but you get suspended into the SRF process and you can't make changes in the SRF process, then the timing of it, based on where everyone is at in their rate proceedings, if they haven't filed one or they just got done with one, I think it goes back to how the OAT gets filed, what the effective date of that OAT is, or what the ask is of this body of the commission, and then each individual entity will have to act. That's something that we all understand is going to be different for each utility, and we're trying to come to a kind of a clearer path forward on that.
Has the working group looked at the FERC allocation manual regarding the functionalization of costs? And I think that spells out really the methodology by which FERC, you know, recommends. And you know, that includes general plan depreciation, A&G, and so forth.
Well, sir.
Through whoever. Yeah, so with Homer Electric not having a wheeling rate, when we looked at trying to figure out how to develop an ATRR, I think where I started was, how is everyone else doing it? Can we do it consistently? Is there a clear path to regulatory approval for this process? And so we've just started meeting just a couple weeks ago, and the initial request out to the utilities, we presented basically the FERC set of accounts that Carl had provided and a list of allocation factors that are commonly used in FERC, and what our initial take would be for each one of those FERC accounts, how we would go about potentially needing, if we needed to do an allocation, how we would do that and what allocating factor we would use. We're looking for feedback from the rest of the utilities to make sure that we're all in kind of line with the way that we've presented the approach. And then we were hoping to kind of develop a formulaic rate that we could put in front of the commission that we would send out to the rest of the utilities, get everybody to fill in all of their details essentially, but really kind of just focused on the approval of the formula by which we're going to come up with this rate for the that would be covered by the OAT.
So. Okay, no, that's helpful.
And if less numbers as allocation factors right now.
And if it's, I'm sure you already know, Chugach uses the FERC methodology for functionalization, and we have for many, many years. And it actually worked very, very well. And it is fairly straightforward. The only one and it's a big dollar item, I think that we'd have to look at maybe in a different light, would be the allocation of long-term interest expense and short-term interest expense, which is a big driver in the calculation. So, but we would be happy to share any of that information with you guys. Brian?
Yeah, sure. I think I was following the conversation, and I'm wondering, in the development of each utility's individual ATRR, do you envision a process where each one of us, including the Energy Authority, go to the Commission and get our portion of it approved, or does each body get it approved by their regulator? So for the co-ops, it would be the Commission. For Seward, it would be the City Council. And for AEA, it would be their board, I would assume. And then that number goes forward as the approved ATR, or have we talked about that?
We have talked about that. I don't want to get into a lot of detail about that right now because I think as one of Carl's documents, you know, that we were discussing later will kind of show the kind of path that I think you're alluding to and how we do that. I think, you know, ultimately, you know, the commission has eyes and oversight over this entire process. So I'm sure they will be looking at whatever approach we take with great detail and we'll be looking at it thoroughly. So, I don't think we really have arrived at a process for how that would look like. I think initially it would make sense just to go through that process on an individual basis, but, I think, Carl's diagram that he can speak to a little bit later and today, this afternoon, will kind of show that a little bit more. And there is a lot more nuance to that than even I was thinking initially. So,
thank you.
So another quick question. So where are you on the allocation of BTS costs? And I think, that, you know, in general, I think it's on a coincident peak basis for transmission-related costs, although I see a value in kind of a hybrid approach as well because there's no question the transmission system is sized to meet peak. But that same transmission system doesn't just meet peak. It also is used to transfer energy. So where's the working group on that?
So, and Ms. Moreau can fill in, we have been looking at a slate of various options that do include both coincident peak, load ratio, a combination of both. Homer Electric put together a proposal that looks at the more regional versus local approach as well that I think is definitely worthy of consideration as well. I think we have not made a firm decision yet because I think we have looked through a lot of these options, and I think further in your packet you will see kind of an effort that actually Chugach assisted us with in to kind of present that in a way that's kind of easily understood and kind of easy to follow, and then how we can kind of morph between those various options. So I would say we've moved along to present those in a way that is easy to follow, but haven't made a firm decision yet. A recommendation.
Oh, that's fair. The other question, could you talk a little bit about the existing agreements? And I think we're really primarily looking at Bradley Lake, I think, is the overarching.
Yeah, we and that's something else too for a further discussion today. But we have had many discussions on the what we call the grandfathered agreements. It's not just a Bradley Lake agreement. It's the IMC agreement. It's the MEA CEA power pooling agreement. We've had some conversations with the BPMC Council on the Bradley Lake agreements. There is a lot in those agreements that doesn't make it a very easy, answer right now on how we treat those, whether you grandfather the entirety of the agreements, whether those are direct assigned costs to, those individual entities, whether you can do like a grandfathering of some of the rights, but then the cost allocation is treated differently. That is something that the working group continues to really discuss. I think between now and the next governance committee meeting, we'll probably have a more firmer path forward on that and a recommendation. But at this stage, it's still kind of the due diligence and understanding with the time we have left to get an ode prepared and filed, what we want to do with these agreements and how we want to treat those.
Okay. Nope, that's fair. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, just on that point. So there's not a direction one way or another on what we're looking at and doing with those agreements?
At this stage, no. I mean, I'm sorry. No. It's because as we've gone through the process and we see the impact of those agreements on various entities, allocations. That has spurred more questions on, well, how are those allocated? And as we've been going through this process, we've been learning more about just how the little eccentricities that there are with some of these agreements and how they are treated financially. But I would say we are close, but as of right now, no.
Let me tweak the question a little bit. Nobody, and I'm just asking the question. Is there a thought that we need to re-enter and renegotiate these grandfathered agreements, or it's a matter that we are going to use the grandfathered agreements? We just need to figure out how they need to be put into the oath.
Yes.
So nobody's looking at blowing up the agreements.
No.
You guys are looking at how to include the agreements going forward into the oath filing.
Yes, thank you, sir. Okay. That's a good clarification. Yes. I would say emphatically between now and July 1st, we don't have time to
exactly.
open those agreements.
Okay, we're,
so
we're
I
good.
I want to make that very clear. So yes, no. Yes,
okay.
Sir.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions for Daniel? Thank you, Mr. Heckman, for that presentation and introduction and overview. So I think the next thing we have on our agenda, we do have a couple topics that need to be discussed within executive session. So we would be looking for a motion to go into executive session to discuss that, which I believe, Brian, you have a copy of that in front of you.
I do. I move that the RTO enter into an executive session to discuss confidential financial matters related to RTO finances and legal strategy. This is consistent with our bylaws, which allow a board to consider confidential matters in executive session. In this case, the RTO believes that these are subjects that would have an adverse effect upon the finances of the RTO are being discussed with an attorney, the immediate knowledge of which could have an adverse effect on the legal position of the committee, or are protected by law due to rules protecting personal privacy and certain business information.
Second, Arthur Miller.
Okay. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we do a roll call vote since we've been doing that all day long.
Okay.
All right.
Alaska Energy Authority?
Chris there, yes.
Chugach Electric Association?
Arthur Miller, yes.
City of Seward?
Brian Hickey, yes.
Homer Electric Association?
Sarah Lamb, yes.
Matanuska Electric Association.
John Sinclair, yes.
And Golden Valley Electric Association.
Travis Million, yes.
The motion carries, Chair. Okay. You're back on the record, Chair.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer. All right, now that we're out of executive session, I would advise that the RTO has not taken any formal action on the matters discussed while in executive session, except as authorized by the bylaws in Section 5.12.2 to give direction to an attorney or negotiator regarding the handling of a specific legal matter or pending negotiation. With that, moves us over to item number 10, member comments. Sarah, I'm going to start with you.
Thank you for having me today. Again, a huge thank you to the working groups and the technical committees and the legal groups for helping move this along. Thank you.
John? Maybe?
There we go. Yeah, no, definitely share Sarah's comments. Appreciate the work that everybody's been putting in to try to hit this target of July 1st. So a lot of work's been done. A lot of work will continue to be done, and I'm just grateful.
Echo those comments. Thanks to Carl. I know you've taken on quite a task here and appreciate your sage advice. And Jennifer, thank you for making all this happen and keeping us connected and people online and offline. Although, I'm not sure I like the thermostat thing. I think so.
Curtis.
No, I want to thank everybody, especially the working group, technical group, Jennifer, everybody, and I really appreciate this public session. I think we're able to put a lot out there. I think people now have an understanding of what we're doing, what we're going through, and appreciate it if we can continue this. But I do thank you for this.
Arthur. I echo everything that's been said. Really appreciate the efforts of working group. I know Carl coming all the way up for this event. Really appreciate it. I also want to express appreciation, I think, all of us on this committee for making the necessary approvals that we did to really advance the ball, to keep moving the process along. We may not agree on every little thing, but that's okay. We're moving the ball, and we need to stay focused and get the filing done by July 1, and we're doing that. And I think we're working very well together to accomplish that. So thanks to everyone for the collaborative nature of these efforts.
Yeah, and I will echo those exact comments. A lot of work went into today, and a lot of work that led up to today's decision-making process. Whitney, thank you for sitting in for Tina today. Welcome to the crash course of RTO. And Carl, thanks for coming up, doing this in person. I think it was very beneficial to have you here and be able to shed some light on a number of the topics that we're wrestling through. All right. With that, our next meeting date is scheduled for May 28th at 9 a.m. right here in this room. And with that, because I was informed I needed to, I need a motion to adjourn, please.
So moved.
All right. Any objection? Hearing none, we are adjourned.